Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Looking for...
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast, the last one of this year. I'll tell you about that in just half a second. But Jalene Jordan, welcome back.
Peter, hello.
All right, wait a minute. I got to check my levels now. Everybody's saying you're louder than me. I know this is our constant joke. All right, talk
to me. For years, we've been going back and forth about who's louder. And, you know, the funny thing is a friend of yours said, you know, I really like you and Jalene together, but she's always louder. You need to talk to your engineer. And you're the engineer.
I am the engineer. So if we're not equal, these, what I'm looking at
levels.
Here, these bars, what do they call them now?
Levels.
Levels, these levels. Yeah, welcome to the industry.
So it is a bit bittersweet, Peter, our last show of the year.
Yeah, and we should tell people why, because this is just December something, what, 16th, right?
Yeah, right.
And so the 23rd we have off, and the 30th we have off, which is pretty much WRIF policy, so we always miss those Sundays.
Yes.
And we're going to miss you folks, because we only do this once a week. And when we used to do the show 5 days a week, we'd say, oh, great, we got a day off.
I know.
But now, man, so it's going to be, I can't even
we'll
do
be back
it.
In 3 weeks.
Wow.
That's hard to wrap my brain around. But
yeah.
I will say, you know, in case I forget by the end of the show that it's been a great 2007 being on the air with you. And
well, thank you.
Yeah. And having the listeners, all the great listeners, call in every week, 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah. What? I've just looked at some. Never mind. I was just looking at the screen.
Distracted.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That's it. That's it. It's a talk show. Yeah, I got distracted with technology.
Is it on?
Yeah, I'm looking at some totally weird screen rather than the one I'm supposed to, but I'll take care of that in a minute. Yeah.
Okay.
We are a phone-in talk show. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. We'd like to hear from you at 313-298-WRIF, which is also...
It's 313-298-9743.
And for the bashful or for the times when the phones are completely jammed, call talkyes@yahoo.com. Now, you know, some of these morning shows, you know, people get paid like $1 million a year to talk about what they're going to, you know, these
Britney Spears.
Oh, yeah, but worse than that, what they're going to buy their spouse for, you know, that kind of stuff. So I don't want to get into that too much, but on the other hand.
You mean over consumerism?
Yeah.
And the holidays?
But.
Yeah, you know.
Do you do any of that? Do you do Christmas shopping?
Not much. Not much. I'm not an over consumer by any means when it comes to the holidays. No. And in fact, I'm amazed at the people in my family. I called my mom yesterday. Every time I've called her in the last couple of weeks, she's been at the mall. You know, and I'm thinking you're filling your whole life with this shopping, but go ahead and send him on up to Detroit. I'll take him.
Well, listen, if people had our views, we'd sink the economy.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so shop till you drop, people.
Right, there, yeah, yeah.
Actually,
And with Riff clients, with our
advertisers. Particularly the ones you hear on Night Call.
Yes.
Tell them you heard it here.
Right.
And you'll get a 0% discount.
Right.
But one of the things that I've been doing over the years, now we don't buy for a lot of kids or children, mm-hmm. which, you know, they want little gifties. But the, you know, the kids that we are, do buy for, we buy, you know, the usual junk. But for adults, no more gifts. I mean, almost everybody we buy for in our family is like middle class. So what do they need? Another tie or something like that?
Yeah.
So what we've been doing, well, I'll use the example of my dad and his wife. We say we have made a donation to the Sea Shepherds Conservation Society.
Fabulous.
In your name. And the reason, I mean, the Sea Shepherds now are going down to Antarctica to take on these Japanese whalers that are going to start killing these enormous mammals that are
beautiful.
Endangered. And they say it's for research, but it's going to wind up as sushi.
And it's going to continue to destroy the whole entire ecosystem.
Yeah. So better that the Sea Shepherd should have the money I would spend on some gift that neither my dad nor his wife needs, which they would admit. But here, it has a double effect. So guess what they've been doing over the last couple of years? They've been donating money in our name.
To some,
I think it was Farm Sanctuary or something
that.
Yeah.
Well, it's that whole ripple effect that you ingrained in my brain and that I continue to try and do in my life. Mm-hmm. You do, you tell people and other people do it. You know what I bought my nephew last year?
What's that?
A goat.
A goat?
A goat, you know. But you know how you can do this, how you can purchase a goat for a family in Africa?
Yeah.
And then they have milk. And he thought that was the coolest gift he had ever been given.
You know what? That wasn't Farm Sanctuary. It was that. I forgot what the name of that group is.
I can't remember it right now either. Yeah. But if you Google socially conscious or
something.
Yeah, just be creative. You'll find it.
The other thing to do is, for instance, I wanted to put this on my website as well. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. There's a little link there that says, End Compulsory Consumption, Christmas Resistance, Boycott Christmas. But I have underneath it, but if you must shop, check the site below.
Okay.
Except I don't think it has the word check there. It says, but if you must shop, the site below.
Well, people will get it.
Yeah, they will. I need a proofreader.
Our listeners are pretty bright.
Yeah, you know, every once in a while, people will email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and say, this link doesn't work, or you left out a word, or something like that.
Oh, you know.
And I appreciate that.
People are watching you, Peter.
Yes.
Hence all of the colorful emails we get every week.
Right. But in any event, you can go to this link, which goes to a link on my site, where it's paraphernalia, peace and social justice paraphernalia, and there's tons of gifts you can give people. And it's not all just, you can get bumper stickers there that say impeach Bush or bring the troops home.
T-shirts.
Or something like that. But there's also a lot of environmental stuff, so if you want to get calendars of birds or stuff like that, you can do that as well. So, all right. So, while you were absent, we were talking about a key phrase for this show. And I was mentioning our colleague Mike Malloy, who has the wonderful thing about after he gets done raking the Republicans, he says, have I told you tonight how much I hate these people? So I said, I couldn't think of one. And someone,
he makes us look very nice, by the way,
for those of you
who think we're too hard on the world.
But I was beginning with, and I like this one, I don't know where to begin. I like that. But someone said that we should use that, what's at the top of my website, which says another world is possible. But sometimes I even wonder. I mean, the folks running this have destroyed it so badly. I mean, here's this Bali conference, which they said they're going to try to cut.
It's all about the climate.
Yeah, there's no goals. But they want to reduce emissions by 2050. And on the other hand, the United Nations scientists are saying, we got about 10 years to turn this around, or stuff's going to get real ugly. You know all those science fiction things, big waves coming over New York City and what have you?
You know, it's really at the point when you say, you know, another world is possible and you question it. The question is it salvageable at this point? I know that's depressing. But
yeah, it is. Well, we were talking about the Sea Shepherds. There's something, for instance, a little factoid that there's so many of, that 1 million styrofoam cups are thrown into the ocean every single day.
No.
Yeah. Now, how do I know? The Sea Shepherd counts them. No, they are able to estimate. I don't know how they know this, but that's a figure. I mean, because if you're working on a ship, generally everything goes overboard. Yeah, that's where
you
get
awful.
Rid of stuff. Yeah. So just the mere existence of so much plastics in the world threatens us greatly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, here's a little something that will cheer our hearts. Actually,
please.
It'll cheer 1% of, probably no percent of our audience, but overall 1%. The report says that the rich are getting richer faster, much faster. This is from December 15th, New York Times. Now, listen to this, because I misread it the first time. Because we always know the rich are getting richer, the middle class is losing wealth, and the poor are getting poorer.
Especially in the last 7 years.
Yeah. The increase, what is that? That's from 2000, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. The increase in incomes of the top 1% of Americans from 2000 to 2003 to 2005 exceeded the total income of the poorest 20% of Americans, and this is by the Congressional Budget Office. The poorest fifth of household had a total income of $383.4 billion in 2005, while the increase in income for the top 1% came to half $1 trillion, a figure 37%. Now, what they're saying, it's not that they got richer by that much, that the amount that they got richer for was greater by more than a third of the total wealth of, let me see, how many people was it? Somewhere in here, I thought they, well, the total income of the top 1.1 million households was $1.8 trillion, or 18% of the total income of all Americans, up from 14%. And now, this is socially engineered, folks. This is not just things kind of making its own way along. This is wealth that's produced.
Wealth by design.
Yeah. Well, wealth is created. There's wealth creation, and there's always a social political decision about how is it distributed within the body politic. Mm-hmm. The state of Massachusetts called the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So how is the Commonwealth, the wealth that all of us produce, how is that distributed? Well, Bush Incorporated, this racket posing as a government, that could be one of my little phrases, right? It is.
It already is.
It already is.
It
yeah.
has been for years.
Yeah. I mean, I want to.
Are you looking
saying,
for that phrase?
No, I want that to sink in because people have to understand that, because something announces itself as having a definition doesn't make it so. I mean,
true.
I can say I'm the noble Duke of York.
It's just words.
That doesn't make it. So this really is a racket to guarantee the extraordinary transfer of wealth to the,
to the top 1%.
Yeah, why 1% even? I mean, the top 10% have made a lot of money, too, but the sure. top 1%. So, that's all right. So, here.
So, that's a sad state of affairs.
But on the other hand, we have, for instance, in the Bronx, Henry Wren's home. Two-bedroom Bronx apartment. He and his family do not live there so much as survive there. This is called Without Heat in the Bronx, Making Do in the Cold. Their building, a five-story walk-up at 1277 Morris Avenue, has been without steady heat and hot water for months, he and other tenants said. Residents dress for the outdoors even while indoors, wearing scarves and hats. They use the stove as if it were a fireplace, huddling around it with the burners aflame and the oven turned on. They wash up in the morning with water heated in pots. At night, the temperature drops to the low 30s in the stairways and hovers in the 40s and 50s in the room. In one living room, the television set is the only source of light after sunset because the light fixture in the ceiling is broken. In one kitchen, a chunk of ceiling has fallen. In a bedroom, a wide swath of greenish-black mold covers a wall. Space heaters sit on a rickety milk crate and chairs. The roof leaks.
Well, are we talking about the East New York East Side tenements here?
Or, I mean, are we talking
right.
about...
What era is this?
Yeah. Well, 100 years ago or now that we call the Third World.
Hey, I have a solution, though.
What's that?
Mr. Chavez. He can take care of them. You go. With the heating fuel.
Oh, with the heating fuel.
And he is giving that, that
Where
to...
Where is he?
It was the Bronx.
Yeah, it was the Bronx. So why aren't they getting it? But
They need to sign up.
Everybody's not doing real poorly. You got a New York Times their Sunday Styles section.
Oh, yes.
And by the way, I suppose that Henry Wren's family in the Bronx that's cold and without heat or hot water is not going to be buying this. But the top 1% whose income has exceeded the increase in their income in 2 year period was increased more than the wealth of the poorest fifth of households. So what are people buying if you're in that top 1%?
Well, if you go shopping in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times, you can get this lovely little Gucci bag. We'll start small, okay, Peter?
Sure.
Let's see. Gucci bag, they start at $585 for tiny little kind of evening bag.
An evening bag.
Yeah. Okay, so then we go to the next page. This is unbelievable. And you tested me earlier on this.
Sure.
And I did not guess. It's a white South Sea cultured pearl necklace. It's quite lovely, I must say. $1 million.
Wow, I'll take two.
$1 million.
Yeah.
And I like I was saying, someone's going to buy that.
And I wonder what these people think that put the New York Times together, because these articles that are such exposés that the rich are getting richer faster, much faster, according, and think about the headline. And then this heartbreaking article, I just read the first couple of paragraphs, about this family forced to live without heat. And isn't there, there's another bag in there, isn't it, for thousands?
That was $5,000.
Yeah.
Where was that one?
Right there.
Here we go. The Bottega Veneta, something like that. It's a spotted print bag,
$4,300. $4,300 could pay for the heat for Henry Wren's apartment building. Now, the other thing is, who buys this? Over 100 years ago, my brain has lost the man's name, but a sociologist talked to Veblen. Veblen, what was his first name? I can't think of it. But anyway, he talked about conspicuous consumption. Now, it's not being done. In other words, people consume at this level. When we're talking about million-dollar necklaces and $4,300 purses, they're doing it to be conspicuous to people that are in the same social class. Because if someone walked in the room with a million-dollar cultured pearl necklace and holding a $4,300 bag, it would be totally lost on me. Because if you, I wouldn't expect you to have something on worth $1 million, but neither would I expect anyone else. And if someone said to me, what do you think that necklace costs? And I'd probably say, $1,000? And how much do you think that purse costs? I'd say $49.95.
Which is still pricey in my book.
Because it's such a scam, because there's nothing. It's not the materials in this purse that may wind up to be $4,300. No, right. But isn't it obscene that kind of disparity of wealth and poverty that a good American family sits in a cold room in the Bronx without heat or hot water, where other people are buying $4,300 purses?
And there's homeless people lining the streets right down from Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And one of the ways this could be ended is by proper taxation, so that there's not that much expendable wealth on the part of the people that have been able to politically and socially engineer that they get wealthy while other people live in such abject poverty. It's a matter of taxes that people get, $1 million, and then it's 90% taxes.
There you
after
go
that.
Again,
yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, confiscatory taxes. This commie wants.
I was just going to call you.
Yeah, eat the rich. Eat the rich, man. They are eating us. So why should we? Yeah, right. But and they helped their own. Harvard University announced on Monday that it would significantly increase financial aid. Isn't that nice?
Sounds nice.
Sounds nice.
That it offers
to middle class and upper middle class students. The move to go into effect in the next school years appears to make Harvard's aid to students with household incomes from $120,000 to $180,000.
So they get a break?
They're going to get the break.
They're rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
well, they're not rich. They're middle class.
Oh, well, sure.
Yeah, they're just middle class.
To a lot of us.
Yeah. They're going to charge them, 10% of their family income. So if they're making if a family's making $180,000, they could charge $18,000 for tuition as opposed to $45,000. I mean,
this is absurd.
It is insane. And this goes back to what I always say. Why isn't college free? Or why doesn't
Absolutely.
State university? I mean, if these people want to offer the university courses at $45,000, let them. But there ought to be comparable quality schools that are free to everyone in the way that high school is. I mean, or why not charge for high school? Yeah, why not for public high school? The money's all gone. I mean, in the meantime, here, students in the United States, remember, United States, number one, except we...
In everything horrible.
Yeah, nothing good. That's what's happened. This is how far down the drain we've gone.
Yeah.
Students in the United States are lagging behind their peers in other countries in science and math, according to this test administered by the Program for International Student Assessment. When compared with... All right. The test was given in science. American students had an average score that was lower than the average in 16 other countries. Pardon me. In math, they did even worse, posting an average score that was lower than the average in 23 other countries.
Wow.
I mean, this is shameful, folks. And sometimes, I know people don't like me saying this. Like, you're not supposed to point out that Uncle Sid is drooling at the Christmas dinner. I mean, it's rude.
Okay.
So this is our, you know, patriotism, patrimony, our patriotism. We don't point out how horrible things are in the country that we're supposed to be proud to be an American. But we have to be proud of what we could accomplish, given the potential and the possibilities, as compared to what we are. Why are we going down the drain educationally? Maybe because you got to have $45,000 to get into a decent school. Now, when compared with, the test was also given to students in about two dozen countries that are not part of the industrialized group. When compared with the broader group, the American students fell in the middle of the pack in science and did somewhat worse in math. So, we're sort of around where Botswana is.
Really?
I mean, yeah.
Oh, my
yeah,
God.
Yeah. So, let me see. I think they're here even. Reading, top 10, South Korea, Finland, Hong Kong, Canada, New Zealand, Ireland, Australia, Liechtenstein, Poland, and Sweden. Math, Taiwan, Finland. Finland's right up there, man.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hello to our friends in Ulu.
Ulu.
If we're going to get corrected again.
Yeah.
Ulu. We need to get this right by the end of the
Ulu.
Night.
Ulu.
Ulu. I was right. Yeah. Okay, good.
And math, top Taiwan, Finland, Hong Kong, South Korea, Netherlands, Switzerland, Canada, Macau, China, Liechtenstein, and Japan. No U.S. No
number
U.S.
Number what?
Yeah.
Number nothing.
Number 23. In the meantime, the national debt is growing at $1 million a minute. We talked about that yesterday. A ticking time bomb, says the Chicago Tribune. It's the national debt is expanding at about $1.4 billion a day. This is terrible. Absolutely.
Tis the season. Happy holidays.
Yeah. All right. Join us. Do you think we're being too tough on the old U.S. of A? You know, it's not the old U.S. of A. It's not America. It's not even George Bush's racket. But really, it is a social configuration of which we're all part of, and it depends on how we're going to let it function. Are we going to let it function so the rich just keep getting richer, the middle class, the base for the middle class is destroyed, the working class and the poor get poorer and poorer, and the ultra wealthy are going to buy $1 million necklaces and $43,000 purses? Oh, I don't know. Did I get this out about that? I was talking about Thorstein Veblen. Thank you.
Good job.
Came to my brain.
Ding, ding.
That the conspicuous consumption, they do it for their own class.
Yeah.
That I wouldn't recognize it.
Right.
Sometimes, you know,
I would.
If I'm walking down Fifth Avenue, you remember, what was the Three Stooges? They say, society dame. You know, you might see, and
right.
I think, where the hell are they going dressed like that?
The grocery store, Peter.
Probably.
They dress that way for the grocery store.
Because we know now you can go virtually anywhere in Levi's, right? You can go.
Yeah.
Lately, I've been at the Symphony, Levi's, where before.
Do you still call them Levi's?
What do you call them? Jeans?
Yeah. Sorry.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that a faded phrase?
It was kind of cute.
Yeah, okay.
So you wear your Levi's.
Jeans. I don't.
To the Symphony? Really?
I don't wear jeans to the Symphony, no.
Okay. You wear Levi's.
I wear Levi's, yeah. That was a funeral with people wearing Levi's, you know?
Yeah.
Memorial with people wearing Levi's.
Stop it.
All right. Let's get Al from Inkster in on this crazy discussion. Al, it's Peter and Jalene on Night Call. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Al, let me ask you a question before we start. Are you ready?
All right.
You're on the air. Who's louder, Jalene or me?
Jalene.
Really? What?
I think it's how my voice carries.
Okay.
Don't you? Hi, Al.
Hi, Jalene. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you.
I just turned her down.
Well, the New York Times, they get all the expensive stuff. A couple of weeks back in the Detroit News and the Free Press, they had an advertisement for a jeweler offering a $200 diamond encrusted peace sign.
Well,
I guess New York gets conspicuous consumption and we get tacky.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing how the peace sign has become a part of pop culture. And even I noticed that I know people, you know, Republicans who are not anti-war, who wear peace signs because it's now cool.
Oh, come on.
They've
yeah.
ruined it, Peter. We need
well,
a
they've
sign.
Had them, they've had them advertising for Kohl's. Kohl's had them a couple of years
oh, yeah.
back.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
It's in. Hey, it's nice to have that message out and about more, right?
Yeah. I thought it was backed by popular demand. You got a big peace sign in the back of your car.
I'm the real deal.
Yeah, I thought it was large. But then a friend of mine who's a teacher at a private school and kind of conservative school, he had one twice as large.
As mine?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've had peace signs on my vehicles going back to the Reagan administration.
Really?
Nice.
Well, yeah. You know, the Christian right thinks that's the sign of the devil. That's one of the reasons I wear it.
Oh, gosh, I'm going to get a bigger one.
Hey, works for me.
Yeah.
Right on.
What, did you have something to say about the styrofoam cup? That's what it says.
Yeah, I was listening to a National Geographic thing, and it was a ship, research ship. It left Hawaii, and instead of going straight to Los Angeles, it went north and then across.
Uh-huh.
And it was, the reason it did it was, there is, between Hawaii and America, there is an island of trash in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
My God.
Size of Texas and California combined.
Wow, they still do, the Saragossa Sea. Remember that all these ships allegedly would get trapped in off of, or was that the Bermuda Triangle or both? I don't know.
It's between Bermuda and the Bahamas.
Yeah.
And so what can be done about that?
It's just trash that people have thrown off ships or thrown out from, you know, the coast of California and everything. And that's where it's all collected. And it's evidently, it's like affecting the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't get down through.
Well, I know this island off the Atlantic coast where people for years, every day, people would bring all of their garbage and all their trash and even cars and stuff like that. They'd put it on this barge and they'd go about 10 miles out from the island.
I just can't believe they do that.
And then, though, these garbage bags from this island began showing up like on the shores of New Jersey.
Oh, Jersey already has enough dirt.
Right. So they've actually now, over the years, instituted incredible environmental
regulations,
dealing with the trash.
Yeah, one last quick thing. My dog has a peace sign on her.
What?
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
Hanging off her collar with her dog tag and her license.
You're the real deal, Alpha Minkster.
You know?
Yeah.
Thanks, Al.
And she is licensed, but she didn't pass the written part.
Pet your puppy for us.
All right.
And peace.
Peace out. Yeah, bye-bye. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Let me see here. Never mind. More technological stuff, right? Oh, yeah, here. Jillian and I were talking about an alternate way to deal with gift-giving is to contribute to peace and social justice and environmental groups.
Yeah.
And
the
here, we couldn't remember the name of that group that that buys animals for people in the third world.
Yes.
And it's heifer.org, H-E-I-F-E-R, pardon me, H-E-I-F-E-R.org. And there's also something called micro loans that they give these small loans
to women
to start
in third world countries. And that has really been a successful venture. And it's branching out to other countries. And it's really wonderful because a lot of these women otherwise wouldn't have no opportunity to make money. They would go into poverty and eventually, you know, sadly enough, die. But heifer.org, that's good to know. And even if you go to it and look at it, the idea of buying a goat for a family in Africa probably sounds expensive, but you can buy, like, part of a goat. Or you can, there's chickens, and there's all kinds of things that you can do. You can just do a donation, and they'll, you know. So it's a wonderful thing, and I obviously am still happy with the goat that I bought for my nephew last year.
There you go. The other, for the microloans, it's Kiva, K-I-V-A dot org. It must be org.
Yeah.
This is O-R here. Kiva, K-I-V-A dot org.
Great.
And Pam, who sent this to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, says, we'll miss your show the next 2 weeks. Happy holidays. Indeed.
Thank you, Pam.
Yeah, thank you, Pam.
Very much. What did we do?
From Finland.
Oh, see, here we go. They're correcting us again.
Yes.
I was right, wasn't I?
Jacob, our faithful listener in Oulu, Finland.
I was wrong.
Yeah. What did you say?
I said Oulu.
Oulu. Oh, yeah, I knew that. Oulu, yeah.
Oulu.
It's O-U, yeah.
We're going to get it right.
Yeah. It's O-U-L-U.
Oulu.
O-U-L-U, yeah. And you can Google that. It's a great little city. They got a nice website. And Jacob has said, come visit.
Would love to.
Yeah, but let's go in the summer.
Okay,
all right.
Deal.
It's bad enough here in Detroit with 10 inches of snow.
Yeah, well, you're going south.
Yeah.
Again, aren't you, Peter?
I am, but we're not talking about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yet. We will.
Okay.
It's a good teaser.
Okay.
When we come back in January.
I've been told I'm good at that.
All right.
But it's a radio tease.
Yeah,
see.
Right,
yeah.
Right. What? And here, Jacob in Oulu says, although it is a great city to live in, we do have a pulp paper factory here. At times, the fumes from the factories stack descend on the city, and it really smells as the pronunciation. Season's greeting to both of you from Anika and me. Anika is...
Is it Anika?
No, I don't know.
How do you spell it?
A-N-N-I-K-K-I.
It's Anika. Hey, Jacob. Tell us how you say your last name. I'll bet you on this one.
Okay, I'll
bet you
you're wrong.
Goat.
Goat. I'll have to tell. I'll tell you. If you win, I'll tell my goat joke.
Okay, there's a deal.
Yeah, I don't know.
I can't believe I haven't heard it.
Okay. I donate a heifer. I think that's part of the name. Right. Says Mary, who's listening. About consumerism, interesting 20-minute clip at storyofstuff.com. Storyofstuff.com. Please check it out. Every American should see this clip.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Let me see more. I don't know if I want to read this to me. I'm going to have to. Dear Peter and Jolene, objects of similar type, Al from Inkster was talking about all this floating junk.
Mm-hmm.
Says objects of similar type produce like aggregation, cause similar materials to gather in the ocean. In the South Pacific, there has been found a 2-mile-long mass of condoms.
Ew. Oh, is it time for a commercial break?
Do we believe that? All right. When we come back. Yeah. When we come back, I want to talk a little more about, we've been having lots of fun, but I want to talk about this lawless administration. This absolutely lawless administration has no respect for the Constitution, no respect for our national laws, no respect for international laws. Again, we're going back and revisit this torture question, and now obstruction of justice, the violation of a number of U.S. laws. But there was an exchange I had, which usually I don't do, with a listener who sent in email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm going to read some for that. Jolene Jordan, Peter Werby, 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
We're looking out there.
The pictures,
the
podcast,
the blog,
the special
features
you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
Or check us out at myspace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan in our final show of the year. We're off for the next couple of weeks, so we won't be back till January. Seems
wow.
like a long way away.
Sure
doesn't it?
Does. Well, a lot to happen between now and then.
All right. We were talking some about the economy. The report says the rich are getting richer faster and much faster, and I would say obscenely rich at the same time. So many people are doing poorly. And
that's an understatement.
Yeah, yeah. And things are probably going to get worse. If we're not in a recession, we probably soon will be because of this foreclosure crisis, the debt crisis, cost of fuel, and all of that.
That's so, pretty much what the most financial analysts are saying.
Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah.
It's scary. And just some news came in that Christmas, here we are saying, boycott Christmas, and we're going to sink the economy. Go buy,
no,
shop,
we
shop.
Said, we said shop, but shop with advertisers of the Riff.
All right, but you know, if you remember
or
what I said.
Go to heifer.org,
yeah,
socially conscious.
If you give donations to groups, they spend, as long as it circulates in the economy. I think that's all.
True.
I know
you're reading the screen.
I actually wanted to talk about these destroyed CIA tortured tapes, but this is a long-distance call, so
okay.
we'll get this on. It's Murray from Lansing.
Really?
Murray, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hey, how are you guys tonight?
Let me ask you a question, Murray. Whose voice is louder?
Yours.
All right!
Yes!
Yep.
I love it.
Yep, I'm just calling to give you a shout-out, say hey.
Yeah.
You guys are pretty funny.
Well, good.
We don't even try.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, what? Especially the part about the T's.
Oh.
It's true.
Oh, my. So are you going to buy a goat for someone for Christmas?
No, I'm not planning on it, but I do like goats.
Okay, yeah, especially when they feed a third world country family, right?
Yeah, but since I'm a poor, starving college student, I don't think it's possible.
Okay, well, maybe when you get a job, you can buy someone a goat.
Perhaps.
All right.
All right, Murray, thank you.
All right. All right, talk to you later.
Thanks for calling in at 313-298-WRIF. Here is the answer to the pronunciation of Jacob's wife's name.
From Oulu,
Finland. Yeah, who were in morning drive there.
Well, hey, we're big time,
Peter. We're big time there in Oulu, yeah. It says, you both lose.
Oh, no.
Her name is pronounced Aniki.
Aniki?
Like UN-KNEE-KEY.
Aniki.
Yeah, wow. It must be Aniki, or it could be, yeah, it's got to be like, with emphasis on the first syllable.
So Aniki.
Aniki.
Okay, well, it's a beautiful name, regardless.
It is a beautiful name.
Now we know how to say it. Retaining it, another story.
Oh, even after 41 years of wedded bliss, I still have a problem with pronouncing Aniki's name because of the double consonants. Both of you are duly forgiven. Regards, Jacob.
Thank you, Jacob.
Yeah.
We do have mostly quite forgiving listeners.
We do.
Mostly.
All right. So now this government of George W. Bush, Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, the government posing as a racket. Right. They just figure they can do anything because they've done so much. They've done everything that in any other country in the world other than a crummy dictatorship, the government would be driven from office either
absolutely.
by its governmental procedures
or
a million people in the street. But since neither occurs, that they just feel, what the hell? Why should we follow any law? Because ultimately, if you have any antisocial urges, right? You think, if I do this, what's the penalty, right?
What do you mean, antisocial urges?
If I'm going to say, I'm going to go hit Al.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what would happen?
So improper.
I'd lose my job. He might call the cops. So,
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's not why I don't hit him. But, right. But when you do, one of the things.
Al, we will never hit
we
you.
We will never
we
hit you.
We know you're listening in the
He'd
other room.
We probably kick our ass anyway, right?
With one hand.
One hand, yeah. the point being that we live in a society of law, supposedly, but what's happened that has so eroded so that we are now ruled by men. The very thing, well, you know, I'm getting ahead of my story.
That's the most disturbing thing you've said all night.
Right. Well, this controversy over the destroyed CIA torture tapes is now taking this turn that Congress wants to investigate it, and the White House is telling its constitutional co-equals to stay out of the investigation. They say, you're on our turf.
Yeah, right.
Get out of here.
Uh-huh.
Right. And this is terrible. The administration argued that it was not obligated to preserve the videotapes that were destroyed of these two Al-Qaeda operatives. We're told, we have no idea that they were. I mean, I assume they were, but we actually have no real legal idea that these people that were captured, these two men, and who were tortured. The waterboarding people were Al-Qaeda. We don't know anything about them because they've been held in contradiction of every law, every international principle. So what we have is the word of men that they're not violating these, in fact, in this case, like 600 and 700 year old Anglo-American jurisprudence, right?
And I don't believe them.
Well,
I don't know how I got this skeptical.
Yeah. The administration argued it was not obligated to preserve the videotapes and told U.S. District Judge Henry H. Kennedy, F.O. No, it doesn't say it. He told...
it's like, I didn't read that part.
That demanding information about these tapes could potentially complicate the ongoing efforts to arrive at a full factual understanding of the matter. Well, the deal is that Judge Kennedy ordered the administration in June 2005 to safeguard, quote, all evidence and information regarding the torture, mistreatment, and abuse of detainees now at the United States Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, where these two, let's give them this much benefit of the doubt, that they were Al-Qaeda.
Alleged.
Yeah, alleged.
That's the best word.
But Kennedy had ordered this, to not be destroyed. 5 months later, after a federal judge ordered that evidence not be destroyed, people in the chain of command of the Bush administration destroyed the interrogation torture videos, which involved the suspected terrorist Abu Zubaydah. It's easier. You know, I said this perfectly all right by myself. Zubaydah.
What do I do to you?
It's Abu Zubaydah.
What do I do?
I don't want to say. Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah. And Ad al-Rahim al-Nasiri. That's terrible. My Arabic friends will probably say. Well.
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say, though, that shredding evidence is upfront evidence of wrongdoing?
Oh, well, most certainly.
Yeah. I mean, they did all of this. They disappear everything. Remember, they millions of White House email records were missing in violation of the Presidential Records Act.
Right.
Oh, and so on.
Or that, or they don't recall. They don't remember.
That's the other big thing.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to read, I don't know, this is a little long, but let me see what we got. We can do this kind of quickly. So after talking about the lawlessness and how horrible this torture is, you know, I wondered if this torture went back to the Spanish Inquisition, why I'd never heard of it before. But it used to be called the water cure.
Okay. This waterboarding is a modern term.
No, well,
this,
it is.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, here...
And maybe we should explain. Maybe we're getting ahead, you know...
That people don't know what waterboarding...
Yeah,
everybody does.
I don't know, Peter.
People, they tie you up, they lay you down, they put this cloth over your face, and then they pour water on you so you get the sensation of drowning.
I thought they ducked your head in something.
No,
okay.
No.
You crap. See, I don't even know.
Yeah, you crap your pants, you pee in your, you know...
What?
You think you're dying.
Oh.
Yeah. So here, Brad writes in the call...
So barbaric.
Well, it is. It began with the tortures of the Catholic Church, you know, in the Spanish Inquisition to get people to admit that they were witches or sorcerers.
Oh, don't get me started on that.
Yeah. all right. So Brad writes in, I have to ask you one question about waterboarding. Obviously, you believe this is a torture and should not be done by the CIA. I saw an interview on NBC with an ex-CIA operative who stated they waterboarded a captured Al-Qaeda terrorist. The CIA operative stated... that they received information that prevented a dozen terrorist attacks. This information was corroborated by other sources and saved American lives. My question is this, which has nothing to do with what he just said. Would you be in favor of waterboarding a terrorist if it would lead to information that would save the lives of your spouse or children? I wrote back to him. That's the usual question, but I said, I'll put one to you, Brad. How do we know what the CIA operative said bears any relationship to the truth or reality, since the tapes are destroyed and he conveniently appears at the time when this is all under question and says how effective this torture was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things he said, that they tortured, I don't have his name, the guy whose name I was stumbling over, that they tortured him for 35 seconds, and he began blabbing and telling everything that he knew, and they prevented all these terrorist activity. You remember how long these torture tapes were?
Yeah.
Hundreds of hours. Hundreds of hours.
Okay, so multiply 35 seconds in there,
yeah.
Right?
So why wouldn't they just say, they said they didn't want to show, they had two answers. One, that the torturers might be, the CIA torturers might be subjected to reprisals, which is absurd. And the other thing is that they might be subjected to legal consequences, which isn't absurd, because mm-hmm. this is illegal under international and U.S. law.
But what, that doesn't matter in this administration.
No, it doesn't. So, anyway, I said, I read your...
Sorry.
I read your response, and you never answered... wait a minute, no, I'm getting way ahead of myself. I said, no one up until Bushko disputes that waterboarding is torture. U.S. servicemen have been court-martialed for employing it against enemy captives in wars. Pardon me, from the 1901 suppression of the Filipino Rebellion after the United States beat Spain and then figured, hey, this is our colony,
mm-hmm.
and the Filipinos didn't like it, but there were GIs that were prosecuted for torturing Filipino rebels with waterboarding. And through the Vietnam War, where American GIs were court-martialed for waterboarding enemy soldiers. And also when it was used against our troops by Japanese captors during World War II, those torturers, those Japanese torturers, were prosecuted. I said, if your question acts as a rationalization, why isn't it equally permissible for Iraqi insurgents or the Taliban to employ waterboarding against captured American troops, saying they are trying to avert the wholesale slaughter of Iraqi and Afghan civilians? Beating confessions out of murderers by police, I say, I'm sure, is sometimes effective to convict someone who wouldn't be otherwise, or gaining convictions by denying a guilty person, so-called guilty person, a lawyer. But all of that, plus torture, is forbidden by the U.S. Constitution, as well as U.S. and international law. And this is what we were just talking about. It comes down to whether we have a framework of law which forbids certain practices or the arbitrary rule of men, so that Bushko says torture is permissible, and its efficiency is affirmed by the word of one of the torturers. Because mm-hmm. that's who did it. That's who said, oh yeah, this worked. We got him to confess in 35 seconds. It makes Abu Ghraib possible, or in the U.S., where several hundred murder convictions that were extracted from poor, mostly black men using illegal means that the men turned out to be innocent. On a grander scale, the ruler of men has such arrogance that Richard Pearl, one of the key architects of Bushko's Iraq disaster,
yeah.
admits that the invasion occupation was illegal but necessary. They rule above the Constitution and international law. This is a prescription.
Illegal but necessary?
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so then what about, they have a little more understanding of people who are in poverty and it results in criminal activity so they can feed their families. So that's, why can't they say that?
I had to kill him. He spilled my Pepsi.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What the hell?
Yeah.
So finally, I say to Brad, Bushko is 17th century Europe. Endless wars, authoritarian rule, no separation of church and state, allows torture, arbitrary confinement, government spying, everything the founding fathers hoped to eliminate by writing the Constitution. They wrote this. So this kind of stuff would not occur. And I say to Brad, I advise you to have the faith in the Constitution that the founding fathers did. So I thought,
yeah.
Yeah, he's gone.
Yeah.
What
slam
could he say?
Dunk.
That he would say, he'd write back, well, there goes my argument. I was hoping you wouldn't break any of that up.
But no.
No, he says, in response to your question, I will give the military and the CIA the benefit of the doubt unless there is undisputable evidence that proves otherwise. By the way, I read your response, and you never answered my question, so I'll put it to you again. It's a simple question with a yes or no answer. Would you be in favor of waterboarding a terrorist if it would lead to information that would save the lives of your spouse or children? If not, are there any anti-terror measures that you would be in favor of?
People always have to do that, and then with the death penalty, too.
Yeah. So I write back, Brad, I hate to be mean, but that's really a stupid question. Of course, I'd want there was going to someone would harm. I'd probably want them waterboarded, their fingernails pulled out, their eyes ripped from their head to protect my loved one. But in order to prohibit that type of activity by government authorities, which always winds up to be generalized activity. So in torture states, as soon as you get arrested, you start getting, you know, tortured, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
That rules have been set down to prohibit such behavior. And I write to Brad, you didn't answer essentially what was my question. Why don't you have faith in the Constitution, the laws of the land, and international treaties, all of which prohibit waterboarding? And you never answered why you would believe a torturer. There were 100 hours of videotapes that were destroyed. If they showed how well this all worked with only 35 seconds of waterboarding, why were they so quick to eliminate them?
Right.
And what was on the 100 hours if the guy gave it all up in under a minute? Aren't you suspicious of government agents?
You should always be suspicious.
Yeah. And then I write, I get meaner. For one thing, you don't know what you're talking about. Army rules. He says that he would defer to the military.
Oh,
Army rules specifically prohibit waterboarding. That's why American soldiers have been court-martialed for 100 years when they've done it to enemy prisoners. The U.S. House just approved a measure to require intelligence agents to comply with the Army Field Manual, which meets the Geneva Conventions on the Treatment of War Prisoners and prohibits torture. Get it, Brad? The Army, to which you grant the benefit of the doubt, prohibits waterboarding in its own field manual.
You know, I think really, Peter, that part is really getting lost.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest part of it.
Yeah. Besides everything else this country was founded upon, civilian rule is key. Your willingness to give, quote, the military and the CIA the benefit of the doubt, close quote, is a prescription for fascism. You need to read a lot of history and not be yanked around by the passions of the moment. Trust the military? Try reading the history of the military in Spain in the 1930s or Chile in 1973 for openers. By the way, they both used waterboarding on their opponents, and great sections of the population gave them, quote, the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not trying to run anything real negative on the military. It's that, let me see if I don't say this, but that the Constitution, in this case, was a tremendous mistake, gives civilian control of the military to the elected president. Unfortunately, maybe because Bush had...
Commander-in-Chief.
Commander-in-Chief, yeah. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. By the way, he's not our commander-in-chief. He's not my commander-in-chief.
And he's not mine either.
Yeah, and he's not yours. You're a Republican. He's not your commander-in-chief. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
Right.
He's the president of the United States, one of the co-equal branches of government. Not anyone that, when he's told to not destroy any evidence, says, you know, get rid of it.
Yeah. It's very Soprano-like.
There you go.
Isn't it?
It is.
It really is. They're just a bunch of thugs.
Here's Tim in Lincoln Park. Tim, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Welcome back, Jolene.
Thank you.
Well, I don't want to bring this up, but I think I am. This guy, Brad, he talks about kind of getting these so-called terrorists any way he can, right? Let's say a terrorist was going to attack his family and his kids and so on. Now, we all know these terrorists, they're all against fellatio, right? Well, what if the only way...
Wait,
did you say fellatio?
Yes, I did.
Okay, we're just checking.
You all know what that means, right? Okay. Well, what if the only way to save his family, this Brad guy, he had to commit fellatio to save his family? Would he do it?
He'd probably do it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear any of that.
Yeah, let's move. Tim, let's move on.
No, I really want to hear it again. What did you say?
Okay, I mean, I'll repeat myself. I mean,
Tim. Wait. I have control of all the... I'm the engineer here.
You can tell me later.
Let's go on to the impeached Bush administration.
Okay, well, obviously, what are there, about 2,000 reasons not to impeach Bush and Cheney? I mean, the latest, we have the CIA destruction of tapes. I mean, this is clearly against the law. Even if you think waterboarding is not torture, even if you think that Abu Zubaydah is Al Qaeda, the very destruction of evidence, I mean, violates, I believe constitutional law as well as congressional law. So that's one reason. I mean, another reason is obviously they took us to war on false pretenses. They violated UN charter. Another reason is I've come up with is they're letting go of New Orleans under Hurricane Katrina. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, they were notified, you know, days before that hurricane was going to hit there, and they did absolutely nothing to save that city.
Yeah, and they've actually known for years that they needed to build those levees.
I can do it. Abu Zubaydah.
Good. You're on a roll, Peter.
I'm on a roll.
By hour two, we're always really great.
Yeah, I can get it. Yeah, you're right. And, you know, by the way, now three key Democratic representatives led by Henry Waxman, who has been doing some of the only real investigative work that, you know, ferreting out the corruption and malfeasance in office of Bushco, has now just signed on for impeachment. And I guess I don't have that up on my...
Well, there is a website. It's by Robert Wexler from Florida. I think it's impeachforhearings.org.
Oh, you know what? You're right. It's Wexler. It's not Waxman. I was totally wrong. Yeah.
And he says if he gets tens of thousands of signatures, he's going to take it to Conyers, and supposedly then they'll take it to Pelosi and launch hearings.
Well, yeah. they need to get on the stick here.
Yeah, they do.
Right?
They
do. I mean, you know,
this is for Cheney. This is for Cheney, by the way.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Cheney.
Yeah.
Well, it was about time they included him in there.
Thank you very much, Tim. And we're going to take a break, get into our second hour. You can join us at 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
Right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Another dream goes up in the smoke.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour and our final hour for this year, because we're going to have next week and the week after off. I do not have a mouse in my pocket. I'm with Jolene Jordan.
You have here. A loud mouse across the console.
A loud mouse. Mouse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, at 1 a.m., about an hour and 10 seconds. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be interviewing, pre-recorded, but a great interview with Jonathan Schell. He is.
Oh, I remember him.
Yeah. He's written a lot of great books, and this one is called The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger, if you weren't frightened enough.
What are we going
to the John and Yoko Christmas song, the thing for something or other.
Happy
Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year at something or other without any fear.
Oh, right. Yeah. Happy Christmas, war is over?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a pin. I should give you one of those. It says, war is over if you want it. Remember
Ooh.
That was their campaign?
Yeah, I want one of those.
Actually, these people in Detroit that put together these pins that say that, war is over if you want it, they sent a photograph of all these people wearing them in Detroit at the last Women in Black demonstration in, where the hell was it? I was there. Birmingham, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And this is a demonstration that circulates around. You go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Click on the calendar. Click on the little silhouette of the city of Detroit, and you'll go to my calendar page. You can see all the events that are happening and also all the vigils, stuff like that. Anyway, Yoko wrote back and said it's wonderful that you put those pins together.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Really?
Also, Chris Albers, former president of the Writers Guild of America East, on the ongoing issues in the writers' strike, which is pretty interesting. So, what else? Oh, yeah, this coming Friday, December, what is it?
It's the 21st.
Thank you.
It's the day after Arthur Penhallow's birthday.
Yes. All right. Who is there afternoon?
Yeah.
If those of you listening in Asia.
In Oulu.
Yeah. This is Brian. I wasn't going to read this one. But we got an email from Brian in Windsor. He says, good to hear Jolene back. That's not saying you don't handle it well on your own, Peter, but Jolene has become a great co-host to help keep track of all the BS that's happening.
You can count on me for that.
How do I do this by myself?
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah. But there is something called the Iraq moratorium. Like, we keep thinking, yeah, because Bush's popularity is, who in the hell still supports George W. Bush or supports the war in Iraq?
I read something today that, well, I don't know, Paul Schmoll, right, but it was only, let's see, only 37% think he's doing a good job now.
God, that's up.
Yeah, I know.
Skyrocketing.
It needs to come on back down.
Well,
come on, people.
Yeah.
Pull your heads out.
Right.
Of the sand.
So one of the things that's happening all across the United States, perhaps all across the world, is the Iraq moratorium. And you can go to iraqmoratorium.org and find out where things are happening in your area. This Friday, December 21st, from 5 to 6 p.m., if my memory serves me right, again, you can go to my calendar page and find this all out. And so, do something. I think I've said this before. When your kids, say you're like 15 to 25 or 35 or whatever, something like that, and your kids say, what did you do, Mom or Dad, during the Iraq War? And you said, I listened to some guy, I can't remember his name, on a rock station. But of course, Riff will still be going.
Right.
I won't. But I listened to him. Well, didn't you do anything? Didn't you go on any rallies or demonstrations or meetings? Or didn't you introduce any resolututions in your church or your union?
Sign in your yard.
You put a sign in your yard, something like that. So,
Nope. And she probably will say, I watched it on CNN.
Yeah, there you go. We were talking about the CIA torture. And the torture tapes that were disappeared, the defying a White House veto threat, the U.S. House of Representatives voted on Thursday to outlaw waterboarding, and on a largely party-line vote, 222 to 199, the Democratic-led House approved a measure to require intelligence agents to comply with the Army Field Manual. Jeez, what a bunch of commies.
Wow, they have to follow the rules?
Yeah, which bans torture in compliance with the Geneva Conventions on the Treatment of Prisoners of War. 199 Republicans said, now you're out.
Really?
So the 199 Republicans support
Shocking.
Torture. It's good. And the Army Field Manual provides 19 approved interrogation methods. I would hate to find out what those are. Yeah, and what of the old name, rank, and serial number deal?
Oh, that's gone. Out the window.
But it prohibits the Army Field Manual, folks. It's called the U.S. Army Field Manual.
They have to follow their own rules?
They do. Well, you know, at least they're supposed to. And as I said, is that soldiers going back, U.S. soldiers going back 100 years have been prosecuted by the military, court-martialed, for using waterboarding on prisoners. It prohibits 8 methods, the manual does, including waterboarding. So, there.
Yeah. Just remember, when you're supporting this type of tactic, so to speak, to put it nicely, it's against the rules.
Right. We were talking about the wealthy. And Jamal writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A restaurant in New York which served the $25,000 truffles with gold shavings was closed because of cockroach and rat poop found inside.
Ow.
Keep up the great work.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
I love it. Let me see if I... Oh, good. I didn't...
Do you remember the $75 hamburger?
That's nothing. Yeah. Were you? Yeah, we were there when there was. You were here when we were talking about the $20,000 cocktail.
Oh, yeah.
Edible gold.
Yes. Yeah. She was.
Eat the rich.
Yeah.
Someone who doesn't have a name on it writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. For the Finns, Haskalita Uta Vuta. Haskalita Uta Vuta.
You sounded pretty good doing that.
I wonder if Jacob in Oulu, Finland, could understand what the hell I was saying. Merry Christmas is what it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
Or are we supposed to be politically correct, though, with that? Happy holidays.
Oh, you know, even the atheists. What's the guy that wrote the God Illusion?
Dwork. Not Richard. No, Dworkin. That's the feminist.
Yeah, Richard Dawkins. It's,
thank you. Richard, you can see why I was close.
Yeah, Richard Dawkins, he said that Christmas has become such a secular holiday. You know, people are always saying put Christ back in Christmas.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, Xmas, they hate Xmas.
Yes.
You know, X is an age-old sign for Christ.
I knew that. Yeah,
you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just say happy holidays. Solstice is my bag.
Yeah, it's coming up, the 21st. Hey, that the Iraq
moratorium
is on the solstice.
Yeah.
Doesn't it prove that they are godless secularists or something like that? Wait a minute here. I think you may have. You said, Winston Smith writes in. We can say his whole name because it's obviously, I mean, it could be his
from
name.
1984.
1984.
The book.
But you compared Bushko to The Sopranos, and I haven't even read this. The difference between ordinary criminals and organized criminals is the utilization of crooked lawyers to advise on the ways and means of circumventing the law. Simply stated, says Winston Smith, Alberto Gonzalez was to George Bush what Tom Hayden, played by Robert Duvall in The Godfather, was to Vito and Michael Corleone, and what Bruce Cutter was to John Gotti. It couldn't be Tom Hayden. It was. Well, his name was Tom, the consigliere in The Godfather.
I don't know. It was on.
Well, Tom Hayden is the peace activist and one of the presidents of Students for Democratic Society in the 60s. Married to Jane Fonda.
Right.
Yeah.
Was.
Was a long time ago, but they have kids or a kid. Well, I don't want look. This has got a weird. I'm not.
I can't believe you're reading these emails cold on the air.
Right, I'm not reading this one. Forget it.
Well, now what you've done, you've teased us all.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Let's see. Here is Joe in Morris. Joe, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Peter and Jolene, and we're all on the air together. Hi.
How you doing?
We're doing great.
Great.
Well, I want to talk to you a little about, I always have a thing called Redcoats to Suits. You talk about the Constitution and, the Civil War back and forth. Doesn't it seem like to you, now this is where we're right back, history repeats itself?
Well, we shouldn't be. We should be moving forward. Why are we going backwards?
Well, you sit and look at the old history.
We are going backwards.
The old history back through there. And you sit there and read it, and then you look at what's going on now. I drive a truck, and I get around quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hearing more and more people across this country saying, hey, someday we're going to have to pick up the guns and take it back.
Well,
I don't want to see that happen.
Pick up the guns?
Take the country back.
Oh, my.
You know, you do, Joe, hear people say this. But one of the things that's happening is that we have the reason that the colonialists had to employ armed force against the against the British government is because, you know, they sent troops against us. Right now, we have the ability to organize and to express ourselves publicly. I know that, you know, there's been repression and all that, but that always happens when you go up against the government. You have to expect that. And it's not as bad as it's been at other times in this country, and it's certainly not as bad as people suffer around the world. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing to stop us. I'll tell you, Joe, for instance, if when Bush stole the election in 2000, if there would have been 50 million now, that's really crazy, 5 million, 10 million people out in the street saying, you're not stealing this election for us, George W. Bush would not be president now. And if we sent, just like they've done all over the world, again, millions of people into the street demanding that this government step down, we'd see something pretty different. So it ain't time, remember, you know, violence lasts, dead last, and only when attacked.
Yeah, it's very Tai Chi of you.
You don't get a lot of people doing anything about it unless it totally affects them all. They don't seem to be affecting but small groups here and there.
Well, I don't know. It affects what's happening. You know, when we say Operation, what was Bush's thing? You know, mission accomplished.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the gasoline up to $3 in a gallon. What are you guys paying for diesel now?
Anywhere from $3.54 to $3.79.
Well, that sure affects you, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah. Are you an independent trucker or you work for someone?
Well, I work for somebody, but, you know, we hear the boss. Watch your mileage, you know.
Sure, and when you go to him, Joe, and say, you know, I'd like a raise, he's going to say, I can't afford it. Look at the fuel prices.
That's right.
That's right. All right, well, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for transporting our goods and services.
And as they used to say, keep on trucking.
Right on. Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good one.
Here's Kim and Marlette. Kim, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm back again from last week. Decided to call in again.
Yeah.
And actually, my thing that I was talking about goes right along with this last guy, the price of diesel and what it's going to do to our country.
Okay.
Diesel at its price that it's at right now is way higher than regular gas prices. Usually, diesel is lower because of all of the different services that use it. Trains use it. Some airplanes use it. Trucking companies use it, and as the price of diesel goes up, so does the cost of our goods getting to stores and everything else. And as that happens, those prices go up until this is how inflation happens. If the price of diesel doesn't go down, then inflation, the prices of everything are going to go through the roof. We need to lower our diesel prices.
Well, what's happening is that, as it is, inflation is beginning to crank up. And, yeah, it could be done very easily if there was any money around. If we weren't in debt and going in debt more every single minute that we, you know, hear talking, that, for instance, there could be government subsidies of it. You know, that gasoline, for instance, in countries that produce oil, they sell it to their citizens at like 15 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to, you know, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela. Of course, that's not true in Canada. Why the hell doesn't Canada do that? All right. But thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate it. And thanks for joining us again, Kim.
Yeah, in Dubai, I think that's how you say it, right?
Yeah.
I think it's like $1.50. Compared to here.
By the way, you've probably heard me and Jolene any number of times talk about how the elections were stolen in 2000 and 2004, and you go, yeah, you just say that. More evidence, folks. All five voting systems used in Ohio, a state whose electoral votes narrowly swung two elections towards George Bush, have critical flaws that could undermine the integrity of the 2008 general election, a report commissioned by the state's top elections official has found. Now, Secretary of State Jennifer Brunner said, could undermine the integrity of the 2008 general election. Well, they undermined the integrity of the 2004 election. They did all these little tests with them, and they could be hacked. They're run by Republicans.
The companies are owned by Republicans.
Yeah.
And not only Republicans, friends of Bush. Remember that?
Right. Absolutely. So
is that okay with you?
Yeah. Or is it a lie? We used to say that.
Yeah,
remember,
is that
it a lie,
okay?
Or is that okay?
Okay.
All right, let's continue onward. 313-298-WRIF, Peter and Jolene, and here's Billy and Fraser. Go ahead, Billy, you're on the air.
Hey, what's up, Pete? Hey, Jolene.
Hey, Billy.
And I just wanted to pretty much call in and pass on the information of a well-situated documentary that I kind of stumbled across that pretty much opposes every theory of 9/11. And what they do is they develop ways in showing you not putting words down your mouth or, you know, in your... Sorry. Cut off for a second. But anyways, what they were doing is pretty much just showing you things that are possible and giving you the facts, and you pretty much just realize what and what isn't. And the
what is
the
this? I'm sorry.
The name of the video is Loose Change.
Oh, right? Yeah, we know about Loose Change.
You do?
Sure.
Yeah, I've seen it. You know, though, I'll tell you, Billy, it does have some cockamamie theories in it, though. If you think about this, like they say that the Pentagon and crashed in Pennsylvania were missiles. So then you got to say, like, so where are the flights? Remember that? Where do they show those flights landing? You remember?
No, I believe what they said is that the plane it as it descended, it hit the ground, hit a couple light posts, and then slid into the Pentagon. But what actually happened is that they showed an aerial view. The landscaping was perfect, and then the hole that was in the building, they said, was about 16 foot wide and it was circular, which in no way, you know, the front nose.
Well, listen, I know that. So, in other words, the contention is that it wasn't hit by an airliner, a jet, and it was hit by a missile. So then where are the flights? Where are the planes that landed? So in the film, in Loose Change, it says that they landed in Cleveland for some reason. So where are all the people? Where are the, you know, 200-300
bodies?
Yeah. So the idea is that they could all be killed or something like that. But I don't know. You know, that's stretching it too far.
Is there anything of substance in there as far as you're concerned?
Well, I don't know. I can't remember it too much. I mean, I think it's enough. I mean, I don't have to go beyond the fact that the most catastrophic intelligence failure in American history, that of allowing a 9/11 to occur,
right,
was under George W. Bush's watch. I don't know why he wasn't immediately impeached, driven from office just over that.
Yeah.
He had full warning of it.
You know, Peter, I'm really amazed at how many people have watched this Loose Change.
Well, you know what it says to me? Thank you, Billy. Appreciate it.
Thank you, yes.
It says that here's what I think, that the importance of all these 9/11 things are. I mean, the most important thing would be if what they said was, you know, completely accurate. The second thing is that there are tens of millions of American people that believe that we are ruled by a government so vile that it would kill thousands of its own people for its extended political purposes. I think it just, they're vile enough that they allowed it to happen.
Yeah.
And, no, I mean, I don't think they knew planes were coming for the World Trade Center.
Well, you know what? Before 9/11, and a lot of people just don't really know this, but they were very, very busy planning on going into Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was their, how do we go over there and get Saddam?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, we were talking about The Godfather, and I was wondering whether the name of the consigliere, as Winston Smith related it, Tom Hayden, was correct. Nico in Livonia affirms that, says it was Tom Hayden.
Okay.
Well, that's weird because...
there's more than one.
Francis Ford Coppola. Well, he must have known the name. I mean, he was kind of the same age as the radical Tom Hayden, the anti-war Tom Hayden. So that's curious.
He has did you read that article in The Nation magazine?
Which one?
Tom Hayden, he has
His
Peace Possible. I mean, just to give a plug, if people want to receive, it's a magazine, but it's more of kind of a, I don't know.
Opinion.
A newspaper kind of format. But anyhow, lots of good information in that. You can go to thenation.com.
Oh, yeah.
Check it out.
You know, though, I don't think that article by Tom, who I've known for years and years, delivered as much as it advertised, because I'm not putting you on the spot because I'm putting myself equally.
Yeah.
He said, we can end the war in Iraq, and here's a strategy. Do you remember what the strategy was?
No.
Neither do I.
I'll get it out when I go home.
Well, I mean...
In 3 weeks when we're back on the air, I'll tell you.
Yeah, but so that's what I mean. It's not, there's not a...
A fancy front cover, though.
It was.
It drew me in.
Right. Here's Dan in Brighton. Dan, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hey, Peter, Jalene. How you doing?
Doing well.
Yeah,
yeah, I was price of diesel, you know. Yeah, one thing I don't get is, from what I understand, diesel costs a lot less to refine.
Right.
And so why are our prices higher than gas? It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's another way of big oil, you know, putting a squeeze on us.
Well, you know, I seems like I mentioned this once a long time ago, but when I was my freshman year in college, we read this book called The Octopus about how these railroads were essentially destroyed these small farmers out in California at the end of the 19th century. And at one point they asked, how much are you going to charge? And the guy from the railroad said, as much as the traffic will bear. So that's, so, you know, what they're trying to do is how much can they gouge us for? There's no sense of them commanding a critical resource, understanding how critical it is to our well-being as a nation, like Kim was saying, and that how it's going to raise the price of everything. They don't care. What they care about, can they get one of their CEOs to retire with $45 million in, as a retirement fund? And can they return, you know, the largest amount of money to their stockholders of any corporation in history? Does it screw Dan from Brighton and the other caller? Well, too bad. You know, we're just cogs in the wheel.
Well, and I also think that they realize that the majority of Americans, I hate to say it because it's very depressing, are just apathetic and won't do anything. And that they realize that there won't be a revolution against them, even though people like you and I desire that.
Yeah, we got to stand together.
All right. Thank
That's
you very
right.
much, Dan. Appreciate it. What do they say? Either we got to hang together or we'll hang separately.
You've got a million of them.
Yeah, I do. I do.
Ba-da-ba.
Ba-ba-da-ba-da. This is one of the reasons the Iraq war is out of the news. Everyone's saying, not everyone, but a lot of people are saying the surge, this introduction of about 30,000 more U.S. troops has worked. And violence in Iraq is at its lowest level since the first year of the American invasion, finally opening a window for reconciliation among rival sects, the second-ranking U.S. general said. Now, this is Lieutenant General Ray Adorno. I'm having more. Why am I having so much trouble with pronunciation? You know, here's a confession. I know you're never supposed to confess publicly, but I have always had trouble with pronouncing
really?
Names. Yeah.
Oh, I know that. I've been correcting you for 10 years.
Odierno. Odierno.
Odierno.
Yeah, Ray Odierno, the man responsible for the ground campaign, said the first 6 months of 2007 were probably the most violent period since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. The past 6 months, however, has seen some of the lowest levels. Now, let me see. What did I write here?
And then, meanwhile,
Odierno says, so that kind of defines 2007 very simply. A long, hard fight and a lot of sacrifice by a lot of soldiers, Marines, and airmen to get there.
And where is there?
That exactly.
It's still in hell.
What if, the United States had never been lied into this war?
Yeah.
So that the General Odierno and the thousands, now closing in on 4,000 if you count all the suicides and what have you, and up towards 16,000. So close to 50,000 real casualties.
Right, and then let alone the hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties.
The Iraqis. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. What about those sacrifices? And for what? What's this? All so they could get rid of this shadow of, this army of dust, this shadow government of Saddam Hussein, who didn't threaten anyone, who didn't have weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, you're going to get an email on that one.
Yeah. But so what are we winning here? So things are quiet. Well, things are quiet in Najaf. Some of you probably have even been there if you're a returning Iraq veteran. But here's what it says on today's New York Times. An Iraqi city poised to become the hub of Shiite power. Remember, it was the Sunnis that ran things, the minority.
Before.
Under Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
A millennium after Najaf first became a magnet for Shiite pilgrims, leaders here are reimagining the city, long suppressed by Saddam Hussein, as a new hub of Shiite political and economic power, not just for Iraq, but the entire Middle East. Now, let's see, the shift, is this in here? The shift would further weaken the Iraqi central government and complete Najaf's transformation from a dusty conservative town known mostly for its Golden Dome shrine and soaring minarets into the undisputed center of a potentially semi-autonomous Shiite region with some of the country's richest oil reserves. Well, you think, well, that's good. What's wrong with that? And although Najafis will say little about it, Iran is playing a significant role in the plan, helping to improve the city and its holy sites, especially the Golden Dome Shrine to Imam Ali, the figure most associated with the founding of the Shiite sect, who is said to be buried here. So essentially, what we are doing, and I say we, not just Bushco, not just this racket posing as a government that has given away billions and billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax money rather than using it on ourselves in order to get there, as General Dierno says.
Yeah.
That we're going to wind up creating this government that is in alliance with Iran. Why? Because Iran is Shiite, and so are the majority of people in Iraq.
Meanwhile, isn't the posturing continuing against Iran?
Sure. Toward. Well, they've, you know, in that was all exposed.
They're playing nicey nice.
Yeah, that's kind of gone away.
Okay. Yeah, way to get us all hyped up. Yeah. I mean, we knew better, but a lot of the American public didn't. And then what it turned into, Peter, was that I hear this, you know, people talk to me all the time about their politics, and I think we should go in there. You know, it just created this whole new pro-war frenzy.
Into Iran.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
I mean, people don't realize that how incredibly complex all this is. So they'll say, we got to go in and finish the job.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the job? Why do we take on the job?
Right. And the other argument that just drives me up a wall, and then some, and I'm being nice, is, you know, well, we're going to democratize them. Then they can be a country just as good as ours. Like, get a clue. Leave them alone.
People say that to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I don't know a lot of Republicans, Peter. Yeah. But when they figure out what I am and what I do here,
yeah,
they just can't wait to just get their claws in me.
Really?
Doesn't work, though.
Yeah.
You'd be proud.
Well, where our tax money's going, nonstop theft and bribery, Stagger Iraq is the name of this piece. So this is, you know, our tax money, billions of dollars. But, you know, they've been investigating all of this to find out where all of this billions have been wasted, all these weapons disappear, billions of dollars are unaccounted for and all of that. The FBI is investigating the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction.
Ah, yeah. Go figure.
Yeah, alleging misconduct from former, misconduct. The
now,
investigation
this...
of Stuart Bowen, another Bushy.
Was this the inspection, you mean, when they were looking for weapons of mass destruction?
No.
Or currently?
Yeah, this is the guy that's supposed to find out to make sure that all of the billions of dollars that we've been spending in Iraq, at like Halliburton and all that,
yeah,
is being spent correctly.
Okay.
So he's being investigated for corruption. I mean, it's that bad.
Yeah.
It's that bad.
It's just really from beginning to end.
Yeah. It is one
it is
big
corrupt.
Corrupt thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think we have time for it now, maybe a little later, but Dave Lindorf, who we've had on the show a number of times, says, imagine a campaign, a political campaign, that called for slashing the military spending by 75%. That we could have the biggest military budget in the world and have $315 billion left over for ourselves rather than handing it over to these big, you know.
Sounds like a great idea to me.
It does. Let's see. Here is Marianne in Redford. Marianne, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
You didn't get it, Peter. You didn't.
Oh, sorry. I got a. How do we do this? Oh, yeah. I remember.
You click the mouse.
Yeah. Go ahead, Marianne. You're on the air now. My fault.
Are you guys, like, really believing in Bush?
No, no.
That we have him in office?
Are we what?
Believing in him.
No, we don't believe in him.
We don't believe in him at all.
Okay. Let me tell you something.
Well, let me this tell you something, Marianne. First off, you got to turn down your radio completely.
Oh, yeah, turn it off.
Yeah.
And don't curse. You seem like you're on a roll.
I'm not.
Okay.
listen to this. I'm very angry. Because you know what? Here in Michigan, there's a whole lot of people that need help. You know what? I volunteer at my church.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to tell you what. There's so many people out there that need help. And it's sad.
We know it. We know it.
You know, it's, you know, people got to start understanding that life is not that easy. But, you know, when we have people in these offices, you know, and they don't care, you know.
All they care about is their own, you know, pocket, the money in their pocket. Would you agree with that, Marianne?
I'm saying that.
Yeah.
I'm saying
okay.
That because, you know what? You know, I live on $264 a month.
Bro.
Wow.
I'm poor. Okay? You know, and it's hard. It's hard to do what I do.
Mm.
But you know what?
Mm.
And who can I go to when I want to ask for help?
Where do you get money through the Department of Human Services?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's what the stipend is, man.
Are you raising kids?
It's not hard. It's not just hard. I mean, it is hard for you, but it's literally criminal that we have a world in which people are buying $500 and $4,000 handbags, and we're forcing citizens to live on that kind of limited amount of income.
You know what? There's so many people out there that go to my church, and you know what? And they ask for help. And it really isn't here in Michigan. My dad was head engineer at Chrysler's.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's like, oh, the big three is nothing now.
Yeah.
Right?
I forgot. What do they call now? They call them the Detroit three. They're not even the big three anymore.
Well, it's really not nothing anymore.
Yeah.
You know? And you know what? All these people... You know, we're hungry, and we need to be fed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that cry for that, and the fact that there are millions of people that that go to bed hungry in this country. I mean, they're not starving, but people that go to bed hungry, that have to give up meals, that have to split their meds in half, that, I mean, what kind of country do we want? Is it like this? I don't think so. Marianne, I got to take a break. I don't know. If you can, I don't know if you have email, but if you can email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I might be able to suggest something. But best of luck and happy holidays.
Yeah.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. This is our final segment because we're
off the year.
Of the year. We'll be off for the next couple of weeks back in January. In the meantime, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERB.com, and you can hear podcasts of shows you might have missed. There's archives. There's a jillion links.
Oh, there's that awesome George Carlin bit on religion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's worth going there. And then you have another...
what's his name? I can't think of the comedian.
Yeah.
Carlin. Religion. Never mind. I can't say. But at 1 a.m. Eastern, Jonathan Schell, author of The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger, and Chris Albers, former president of the Writers Guild of America East, on the writer's strike. So let me see here. Yeah, I knew that the consigliere of the Corleone family was not Tom Hayden. That is the political activist.
I was talking about.
Yeah, I know. But it was Tom Hagen.
Okay.
Thank you, Al, from Inkster.
Thank you, Al. I am not a big Godfather.
Oh, I love it. That's why.
Aficionado.
Yeah. H-A-G-E-N. So thank you.
Okay.
Our audience collectively knows everything.
I know. If we need info, we just put it out there and boom, there it is. We love you guys.
James is listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A bit earlier in the waterboarding discussion, Peter mentioned in passing that the suspect, or victim, if you will, thinks they're dying. I'm sure you know, but just wanted to make the point that they not only think they're dying, they are dying. The suspect is, in fact, drowning. So this form of torture is actually a murder in progress, but is terminated short of the actual death, usually.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah. If you go to my website, there is actually a dramatization. It's almost, I don't know if you could call it funny. It's creepy gallows humor in a way, but there is a demonstration of waterboarding, and the result, I think, is very, very troubling, but still worth seeing. All right, did I? No, I didn't do that. This computer is hard to deal with. Mainly because it ain't like mine.
Right. we have quite a few phone calls.
Yes. Here is Al's in Ferndale. Al, it's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
We're doing good.
Jalene, my dear.
Hello, Al.
Sir, happy holidays.
Same to you.
You too.
The young lady that was just on, she had a low income of $200-something a month she lives on.
Yeah. Something like $280 a month.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask you guys, Peter, I'm a Vietnam vet. I'm on a $900 disability a month, right?
Yeah.
And I can't get 100%. And the state here, from what I understand, isn't there a budget crunch?
There is. There is indeed, yeah.
I wanted to go get Medicaid because I'm having a teeth problem.
Okay.
And I can't even file for it because they're not even accepting anybody.
Really?
He has problems. He can't even get dental care, and he served in Vietnam.
You should be getting $10,000 a month for having served in that, another war based on lies, you know?
You know, and I got post-traumatic stress disorder and all that from that, you know, and I filed for Social Security disability over a year ago, and they denied me, telling me that I had to be dead or blind before I could get it.
Wow.
And I can't even file for a state just to get on Medicaid so I can get my teeth taken care of.
That's terrible.
Yeah. You served your country. You were over. How many times did you go over there?
I did one tour.
One really horrible tour, right?
One infantry tour. That was enough for me.
Right. Yeah. And you come back, and have they done anything for you?
For 30 years, I got 10% disability on PTSD, and I realized as I gotten older that it had gotten worse, so I went and refiled. Now I'm at 70%, and they gave me 10% for a perforated eardrum and shrapnel in my chest and leg.
Oh, my God.
And I've been in major car accident, motorcycle accident, and I'm at 57 now, and everything's catching up to me.
Well, you've been bounced around, Al. That's no lie.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm a strong person. Jalene knows me.
Yes, I do.
I'm strong. But,
well, and I'm absolutely incensed with it, what they've done to you.
Well, listen, let's do this. Let me suggest, if you're in contact with Jalene, that she put you in touch with me, And I don't know whether, I mean, it, you know, it shouldn't, it, this is crazy that it should have to depend on some connection that I have. I mean, everybody as a matter of right of being a citizen of this country ought to be able to have the finest medical care, particularly someone that served in the military at the behest of the government. And then the government is stingy with the way it it relates to people. And all these damn right-wing patriots saying, you know, support our troops.
I mean, we do. We want them home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, or somebody like Al here.
Yes.
So, Al, get a hold of Jalene, and she will put you in touch with me, and we'll see if we can work on this. Okay?
Kick out of Peter.
All right. Yeah. What?
Born and bred here. And
all right.
I got to fight to get to try to get anywhere just like that young lady was just dying.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't have to fight at all.
So I was corrected. It was $254 a month.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you, Al. Let's see if we can make it better. But, you know, what I mean, I obviously can't turn out, what do they call, ombudsman. I can't turn out to be the guy that intervenes on the behalf of, you know, my connections.
Right.
And I don't even know if my connections will mean anything.
Hey, it's worth a try.
Yeah. But so for one guy, what about, and Al isn't the only person in the listening audience that's having those kind of problems.
That's right.
With getting the benefits that that they deserve.
We hear it every week.
Yeah. All right, here's Steve in Westland. Steve, hi, it's Peter and Jalene.
Hey,
you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
We're doing good.
I can't hear you. You're going to have to speak up.
Best I can do.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
Can you hear her?
Yeah, I can hear her.
Oh, this is a conspiracy against me, I'm convinced.
No, I heard you guys earlier.
Okay. Talk.
Okay.
All right. I was on a young lady that called in a little bit ago about... the church helping other people out and her not having enough money to live on. I was president of outreach in my church, and that's what we did. We gave people clothing and got them food for so they can have, you know, dinner for Thanksgiving. And I'm kind of surprised that our government, state government and federal government, taking and making the rich richer, and the poor aren't getting anything.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. With governments, mostly, listen, when you go back to the origins of government, the origins of the political state, they were set up as rackets for the rich. And it's been very infrequently when they haven't functioned as that. So but what we've had to do, the common people throughout the history of the world have had to fight all the time to just get an amount or to live a life so we're not slaves. Remember, they wanted all of us as slaves, all the workers as slaves, and then they would have just a little administrative class, and above that, the rulers. Well, we're kind of sliding back into that mode again. So that's why we've got to have a movement of resistance. We've got to recreate that culture of resistance that was there during the 1960s and the 1930s and the 1880s and 90s.
Right. How about when Bill was in term? I was working. I had my own business. I was expediting packages, you know, throughout the Tri-City area here in Detroit. And once Bush got into term, everything went to crap.
Huh.
I mean, I couldn't pay the taxes on my my company. I couldn't make enough money to keep the business going. And I believe it's all because the Republicans get here, and the people that are Democrats are, just
as bad.
No, well,
kind of.
They're not helping out, Julian.
That's right.
Well, the problem is there's no leeway for the state government to do much more, because the Granholm and the legislature as well, Republicans and Democrats, are constrained by the Michigan Constitution that demands a balanced budget, unlike the racket at the in Washington, which can sink us endlessly into debt. So now that we each owe like $30,000 that we're going to have to pay for every man, woman, and children and infant. So there's not a lot of leeway. There's a lot of things that Granholm could do that she's not going to do. But, you know, like these moratoriums on foreclosures, on water shutoffs and what have you. But the larger state of the economy, there's not a lot she can do about that. All right, well, happy holidays to you. Thanks a lot for calling. Something is bouncing around in my brain. What is it?
Well, as your executive producer and co-host, I wanted to say we have a lot of phone calls to give them the proper time they deserve.
All right, yeah. Here's Jesse in Oak Park. Jesse, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi.
Hi, Pete and Jolene.
Hi.
Hey, I just want to thank you guys for raising the awareness on a lot of these issues that you brought up. And it's tough being the little guy, making your opinion heard in the government. I belong to Local 25 Ironworkers, and it takes a lot of money to put in the PAC and the collective bargaining agreements just to get to the table to where we can have something to say in our government. So, I mean, it just keeps on getting harder as the little guy gets squashed and the big guy gets bigger.
Well, it is, and I want to say something, and I don't mean this directed at you at all. Usually people say that right before they direct it at you, but I really don't mean this directed at you at all.
Yeah, or before a racist joke, there's always that preface, you know, that people do. I'm not racist, but this is a good one.
Yeah, but that's a bad analogy with
me. I know with you it is.
Yeah, but anyway.
I wasn't talking about you.
You know, the nurses at the Detroit Medical Center are trying to organize. And the county, I guess, is it the county or the city that owns Detroit Medical Center? Hello, must be Detroit.
Yeah.
Anyway, they are acting like the worst corporation imaginable. They've hired these anti-union consultants. They've just done every anti-union thing imaginable. And I was at a rally there. Let me see, when was it? I guess last Monday. Yeah. And there were people there from all these different unions. I went down with the assistant executive director of my local, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. And there were representatives of, in fact, there were representatives of the iron workers. But what we've got to start bringing out, this is the way it was in the 1930s. You go, oh, that was a long time ago. Yeah, but they kicked ass then. I'll bet you that you did not even know that this rally or demonstration was taking place. Did you, Jesse, last Monday?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, of course not. I'm not to criticize you, but what's got to happen is there should have been 10,000 people down there. Not just union members, but everybody that knows that these nurses that are so critical to health care, that they deserve the right to organize, that they deserve the right of collective bargaining like we all do. And the union should have been turning out tons of people. And it's what I said earlier. Either we got to hang together or we're going to hang separately.
We need mass action.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Mass action will get you satisfaction.
Hey, right
on. As they used to say.
Right on,
Jesse,
Peter.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me. Here's David in Southgate. David, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene. How are you?
Hi, David. Great.
Hey, you guys were talking about a motto or a theme for your show, for your website, and I had an idea from something you, Peter, said a couple weeks ago. Resistance and renewal.
I love it.
Oh.
I think that's what everybody's talking about. We need resistance and we need renewal. Excuse me. We either have to join together in a mass movement of resistance and renewal, or else, as Peter says, we'll thatch our huts.
So, we're going to thatch the roofs on our houses. We're peasants and thatch our roofs. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Peter, I was wondering if you could give us your thoughts about Mike Huckabee, because a lot of people now are saying that he may actually end up being the Republican candidate.
Okay, wait. I have one
yeah.
thing to say about them. Ready?
Yeah.
No way, man.
It's scary to think that he could become the president of the United States.
Well, I don't think
any Republican, but
right.
You know.
I don't think Huckabee. I think is the Democrat is the Republican. When the Democrats' Republican of choice.
Okay.
That, in other words, they think that he will have.
It was Ron Paul,
yeah.
wasn't it? Before?
Yeah.
No, I don't
no?
know. Maybe.
I mean, okay. Yeah, well, what happened, I saw how that his approval ratings went up in Iowa,
yeah.
30% or something like that.
Right.
And then Romney went down that much.
Yeah. The idea, David, that in fact, even Obama. Today he was in church today, talking about his religion and all that. You know, in the Constitution, it says no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And the wording is interesting. No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And we have gotten to the point now where all of the candidates have to pander to this religious sentiment. And, you know, let me just say parenthetically as well, me particularly, but Jalene as well, are often very hard on organized religion. And then I realized by the comments of some of the people today that their churches do a lot of good work in the world.
Well, and we know we march amongst the monks,
yeah,
right, when we go to protests. We know there's a huge faith-based... but I have to tell you something, and I've been thinking about it the whole show, something that I found out last week. The Bush Christmas card, the presidential Christmas card this year, includes religious, he talks about his religion and peace on earth and something may the Lord, something, something, something. And he's never done that until now, because you know what? He doesn't care anymore.
He's out of there.
He is really, you know, coming out, so to speak, with his scary religion and
He's done so much for the cause of atheism. It's absolutely amazing.
So, hey, thank you for that, right?
But let's get back to David. David, I want to thank you. You know what? If I can figure out, I mean, you know, a number of people say, oh, I love your website. In fact, somebody actually asked if I wanted to be the webmaster. On the other hand, most webmasters say you have the most jumbled, hard to read, hard to navigate site I've ever seen in my life.
I get a little stressed.
It's a labyrinth, I have to say.
It really is.
But at the top now, it says another world is possible. And that came out of the anti-WTO demonstrations in Seattle in 1999.
Okay.
But it sounds kind of weak in a way. Another world is possible.
It's like all I see are flowers in my hair and peace signs floating in the air. I like it too.
But if I
resistance and renewal.
If I can figure out how to do it, David.
Okay.
I'm going to put that up there in place. Some people know. Leave it.
It's okay to change it once in a while.
It is.
And we like that.
Thank you.
Great suggestion.
Thank you for it, David.
Thanks a lot.
Bye now.
And
bye.
Thanks for thinking so hard about it and calling in.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Let's see. Let's get to Darren. Darren's downriver. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, outstanding. I didn't think I was going to get a chance to talk. I've been on the hold here for 40 minutes, and this will be the first conservative call that you've taken. And you're Orwellian 2 minutes. Hey, you know, I'm really surprised.
We don't pick and choose.
I would be really, really happy with you guys because you guys know so much that isn't true. For example, waterboarding works. Abu Zubaydah cracked after 30 seconds of it. And
we talked about, wait a minute, how do you know that?
By doing that.
Wait. How do you know that?
Well, you listen to the CIA guys.
That's the point. Hey, don't you understand?
Oh,
that's
my.
The point, that it gets away from the rule of law and instead inserts the rule of men. It allows the torturer to define success and efficiency. Are you that much of a sap that you can sit there and believe whatever anyone tells you? The reason that there is a rule of law, that it allows procedures to take the place of arbitrariness. The whole intent of the U.S. Constitution, Mr. Conservative, is to remove the rule of men, to get the torturers out of public life. That's why there's the Eighth Amendment, because the founding fathers knew that if you allowed men to do whatever they wanted, they would be corrupt and they would be brutal. Do you understand that?
Well, see, these are American laws, though. These are the laws of elected republic. We were doing waterboarding under Clinton. We're doing it now.
If we were doing it under Clinton, I condemn that as well. But let me tell you again that it has been universally condemned that were you listening to the show? GIs at different times in American history have been court-martialed for doing that to prisoners.
Because it's illegal. It's against the rules of
the army. The army itself says don't do it.
Why is it okay then?
You're such an outlaw. You're such a rogue. The hell with the Army Field Manual. The hell with the Geneva Convention. The hell with U.S. law. Is that right?
No, it does not. It does not run afoul of the Geneva Convention. No court has found it foul.
It runs afoul of its very own institution.
Yeah, you know, you're in dreamland. Let me tell you
that. See, I told you, Peter. I told you that that's where the disconnect is.
Well, the disconnect is this is the, you know, you're a spokesperson for what I call the fascist third, because you're the one that approves torture. You're the one that approves arbitrary rule, essentially is the removes the democratic guarantees for what this country should be all about, and instead allows men to define, to rule over law, that law is nothing. That what they say. So you tell me that a CIA torturer, the one who tortured these men, 35 seconds, they got what they wanted, and it was really efficient. Well, why did they have hundreds of hours of tapes? Why wouldn't they preserve that? Why wouldn't they preserve that for the historical record, for congressional oversight? Remember that little institution in the Constitution? You know, you are not a patriot at all. You are a violator of the Constitution. That said, thank you, my friend. Wow.
Do you feel better?
Yeah.
Me too.
I do. Yeah.
Sometimes there's just a big head shaker.
And by the way, Darren, if you're still listening, we do not, you're the only conservative that called is because you were the only you were the only conservative on the air because you were the only conservative that called.
We don't say, oh, it's a conservative, don't take that call. If it's on the screen and it says something about arguing with what Peter said, yeah, if there's something I said, we jump at the chance to talk to you.
Here's what's happening in public consciousness, Darren. Conservatives are going back to the infinitesimally small minority that they are of the population, how they were able to capture the American government and subvert the Constitution and destroy the economy is probably something political scientists will be talking about for a long time. But hey, let's keep it light because we have to go.
Just like Frank and Dean, keeping it light.
Okay.
That's what they did.
Let's move it on.
They kept it light.
But, Jalene Jordan, thank you for being part of this program.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to all of you, the listeners. And so we're taking a two-week hiatus, which means vacation, I guess.
Yeah. Let's hope for at least a little improvement in the year 2008.
All right. We'll see you next year.
This is WRIF.com.
Chicago. I'm going to Chicago.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Remember a few weeks ago we had a spokesperson on from Beyond Nuclear, and I began the show with saying, you know, what year is this? Because it was about nuclear power, and we thought we'd resolve that in the late 70s and the late 80s. Same with nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war. Many of you may remember the book by Jonathan Schell called The Fate of the Earth. This was this book that that really woke us up to the threat that we were all facing, perhaps beyond what many of us knew. Well, Jonathan Schell is joining me once again. Jonathan, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show, because we've spoken before.
We have.
Your brand new book is called The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger. The seventh decade, I assume, refers to that we are now in the seventh decade of nuclear threat?
Yes, it does. It's getting to be about as old as the average lifespan of a modern person, getting there.
Yeah, and so far so good, except for a couple days in August 45, 1945, there hasn't been any nuclear exchange. So is Jonathan Schell and the rest of us just chicken littles?
Well, I don't think so. You know, a very, very curious thing happened at the end of the Cold War, which was that because that Cold War ended, because the political struggle ended, people pretty much forgot about nuclear weapons. And that was a good reason for doing so, because it didn't seem that there'd be anything like a new Cuban Missile Crisis unless there was an accident. But a very strange thing happened at the same time, and that was that the arsenals themselves, both in Russia and in the United States, sailed on pretty much unaffected. The numbers were drawn down a bit. But still there were about 10,000 on each side with, you know, plenty of overkill. So somehow it just turned out that this dilemma, that this threat transcended the Cold War. It went on beyond the Cold War. They entered what I call a sort of policy-free zone. Also, I might add, a kind of thought-free zone. But there they were, like characters waiting for a new play to be put in. And lo and behold, after September 11th, a new play has come along, and we see the whole thing stirred up again. But as I say, it's a new shape. It takes a new form, but we've got to put it back on our agenda.
Let's go a little over the old form, because the new form, and when we start thinking about Pakistan and Iran and Israel and countries like that that possess nuclear weapons that are in these edgy parts of the world, that is a big concern. But the former Soviet Union, Russia, and the United States, why in the world do we even have so many nuclear weapons? Why did they get bid up so much? You would think if each side had 10, that would have done it. But you're saying that there was 10,000, and as Helen Caldicott has reminded us, with a few switches, they could just target Detroit and any other city in the United States that they wanted. So why did they create so many nuclear weapons in the first place during the Cold War, and why does the big powers, the U.S. and Russia, still have them?
Well, to try to answer the first question, which is very hard to figure out, because why on earth do you need to blow up the world, let's say, 400 times instead of, let's say, just 75 times? And that's what happened during the Cold War. I think there are a lot of complicated reasons that I won't go into, but one that I think is pretty simple. And that is that throughout history, people have believed that if you had a bigger club, if you had a more powerful bow and arrow or a bigger tank, you could knock out the other guy and win your war. And when nuclear weapons came along, that whole situation was brought to an abrupt end, because there was no longer any such thing as winning a nuclear war. You know, just a few dozen on each side would completely annihilate the other country, and so the power that won would be as annihilated as the one that's supposedly lost. But that old logic of war, and even just the visceral feeling, all the emotions attached to it that go back to, you know, schoolyard fights and way back into history, has been a very, very tough thing to overcome. So people just had the idea, if we have more, we'll beat the other people, even though that was completely untrue during the nuclear age. Now, when I come to why do we still have them, that's even a bigger mystery to me. But I can again suggest one reason, and that is that, you know, it's may not be the most dangerous moment in the relationship of Russia and the United States. It's not that, but it's certainly the craziest, because precisely because we don't really have any quarrel with Russia that's worth even a pistol shot, you have to ask yourself, why on earth do we still want to aim several thousand nuclear bombs at them and endure, even today, on hair trigger alert, being targeted by several thousand nuclear weapons on the Russian side?
Are they still targeted against us and us against them?
You know, there was something called the detargeting agreement, but the fact is that it was just a fake, because you put in two numbers into the computer, and in a few seconds or minutes or hours, they're retargeted. And the arsenals are definitely sized to one another. There's no other nuclear power on Earth that has anything like what Russia and the United States have. So we're still in that, technically speaking. You know, the Cold War went away, but the arsenals that were built for the Cold War go on, but without any reason. Now, if you can explain to me, or one of your listeners could explain to me, why on earth that situation exists, they're smarter than I am. I can only think of one reason, and that was that the United States, after the Cold War, had a feeling of being victorious, of being dominant, of being the sole superpower and all of that. And it really just didn't fit in with that image of ourselves as sort of a globe-straddling empire or what have you, that we would surrender what even then, to some people, seemed to be a sort of supreme instrument of power, namely the nuclear weapon, even though we would do it to get rid of them mutually with others. And so I think that we kind of slyly didn't say anything about it while and didn't take advantage of that tremendous moment of opportunity to really do something radical to get rid of nuclear danger once and for all.
Now, it's kind of interesting. The least, probably the person we'd describe least as radical was Ronald Reagan, an arch-conservative. But when he met with Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik, Iceland in 1986, they came close to coming to an agreement that would have ended that. Helen, I don't know. You know, I mean, I read an interview of Helen Caldicott, who actually had Reagan's ear about the dangers of nuclear war, and somehow it seemed like, whether it was from her or somewhere, it seemed like he appreciated that fact and came like a hair's breadth from removing this threat.
Well, that's true, and it's really a remarkable fact of history, and it's very underappreciated, because after that Reykjavik summit back in 1986, the fact that Reagan and Gorbachev had not only discussed but nearly agreed, came within an inch of agreeing to abolish nuclear weapons, was considered sort of by the other members of the nuclear establishment to be a sort of disgrace that had to be covered up so that no one would ever know about it. So a sort of spin was put on that meeting that was quite false. But now we can see that the full record is revealed, that really at one moment on the second day of the negotiation, it's really a remarkable thing to read. It's very dramatic. Gorbachev says, well, now, you know, my proposal here, we get rid of all nuclear weapons. And Reagan says, well, now, does that really mean all? Because that's what I want. Does it mean the submarines and the planes and the mines and every kind of nuclear weapon? And Gorbachev says, yes, that's what it means. And at that point, George Shultz, Secretary of State at the time, and who was present in the room, and a very sober and impassive guy, if you think of him, just bursts out, "Let's do it! Let's do it!" An amazing moment of the nuclear age.
Wow, I thought you were going to say the opposite, but go ahead, tell the story.
No, it's not that. He said, "Let's do it." But tragically, as we know, the whole thing broke down, and the reason was that Gorbachev and Reagan couldn't agree on the Strategic Defense Initiative, which Reagan insisted on having and Gorbachev wouldn't endure having, and the whole thing broke down. But they really had the agreement in their hand for just a moment.
Jonathan Schell is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's the author of Fate of the Earth, 1982, very important work about what we're speaking about now. But his latest book is The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger. It's published by Metropolitan Books. You can go to hholt.com. It's available on Amazon as well, and I'll have a link on my site, peterwerbe.com. And I do want to get on to the threats in the different parts of the world, but just a little bit more about Russia. The dangers, I mean, it almost seems that the dangers are somewhat mitigated when you have an extraordinarily strong ruler in Russia, like we're seeing arise now in Putin. However, there are forces, as you know, Jonathan Schell, within Russia that are extraordinarily hostile to the West for lots of different reasons, and it would be terrifying to have those forces actually come to power within Russia. Is there still a political danger of a confrontation with the United States and Russia?
Well, we've really got one in several areas. Putin himself has been playing a very strong anti-Western and anti-U.S. card in his domestic politics. Remember that he actually went to Tehran in Iran and declared that force was not the solution to the problems of their nuclear fuel procedures that they've got going there. So he really went and sat in the capital of a country that the United States has reportedly been considering attacking and said, don't do it. It was it really had a whiff of brinksmanship about it. Also in Eastern Europe, the United States now wants to deploy anti-ballistic missiles to knock down missiles coming from Iran, but the Russians say, no, that will degrade our capability, and Putin is very hot under the collar about that, and he has actually suspended cooperation in an arms control, conventional arms control agreement in Europe because of it. So, you know, great powers, it's not the Cold War, it's not a great ideological struggle, but great powers historically get in one another's faces, and we see that happening increasingly between the United States and Russia. I could give other examples, but I won't. So, you know, even as these new threats start coming from countries around the world, which we'll talk about, we have a kind of revival of the superpower situation, not exactly a Cold War, but a kind of great power face-off, sort of like maybe around 1912 or 1913, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, when and this maybe can allow us to slide into the Middle East and South Asia and the nuclear threat there. The idea, when I first heard it announced that there was going to be part of this missile anti-missile system set up in the Czech Republic and Poland to defend those countries against Iranian nuclear-tipped missiles, I thought this has got to be some kind of joke, right? I mean, this has no possibility whatsoever. I mean, militarily, politically, scientifically, right? I mean, it just seems to be.
Yeah. Well, it's another of those incredibly convoluted and strange things because, you know, most scientists don't believe that those defenses can really shoot down a missile. They really haven't proven that capability. That's number one, it doesn't work. And number two, there's no threat because Iran doesn't currently have any nuclear weapon.
Or why would they attack?
Or missile that can strike that far. So.
And why would they? Why in the world would they?
Yeah.
That's what's so nuts.
So that's right. For them to attack Europe, it just doesn't compute. But at the same time, there's a scientist at MIT called Ted Postol who points out that these systems that they're considering deploying might have some capability in respect to Russia.
Yes.
And that's what got Putin angry and the Russians angry, and that's why they're starting to tear up arms control agreements of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Tell people why shields, missile shields, not only is, technologically, that these things, they're not quite sure that they're ever going to work and haven't had a good track record, but the idea that we should be able to shield ourselves from anyone and everyone, on the face of it, sounds like a pretty good idea. Hey, we'll just put up a nuclear shield, and then nobody will be able to attack us. That sounds like a good program.
Well, I mean, there are two big problems. Number one is that it's never been shown to be workable. That should be enough right there. There's one sort of fatal technical difficulty that no one has come close to solving, and that is that, you know, when countries, if they were to send up a missile, it's a very easy thing to send up some decoys. All you have to do is put some metal balloons up in the area in outer space, so they'll go as fast as the rocket. And there's really no technology, if you put up scores or dozens or thousands of these decoys, that can really distinguish between the real warhead and the balloons or whatever chaff and other rubbish they might send up there. So that's something that really makes the thing sort of quite infeasible. The other problem is that as soon as you say that I alone am defended and I alone am invulnerable, not that it's possible, but if it were possible, then that goads other countries to who want to have some equilibrium and equality with you, not to have you in a position of dominance. It goads them to make efforts to overcome it. And actually, Putin has announced that Russia has, and he doesn't specify what it is, but there are suggestions that it's a maneuverable rocket that couldn't, again, that would evade any anti-missile defense. So the whole thing, which sort of sounds good, there are many things that sound good, but either have no reality or have a terrible consequence, and here we get both of those.
And this is actually just quite mad. I mean, when you think about it, when there's the kind of disputes that involve the United States and Iran, you know, one thing, we're over there fighting wars on their eastern and western borders, but this is not something that you could imagine leading to nuclear conflagration, yet the ante keeps just being out of control of the people responsible. I think that's probably the problem. And the threat just keeps getting bitted upwards.
Yeah, it does. And it seems that a sort of a confrontation is almost being artificially manufactured. And keep in mind, by the way, that when the United States, when the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union, or the then Soviet Union, received guarantees that NATO wouldn't expand beyond a certain point, and especially not into the former Soviet territories. And now we've had NATO expansion into Eastern Europe. So the Russians look at that and say, who's that against? What's that for? It wasn't exactly a peaceful message. So the United States was really delivering a message, we're the boss, and we're the boss in your neighborhood, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians said, no, we don't care to have you to be the boss in our neighborhood. And they started to push back. I dare say the United States would do the same, although it's unpleasant to watch it.
Yeah, why would the Czech Republic and Poland agree to being part of what everyone understands is a technological system aimed at Russia, not at Iran, that doesn't, not even clear. I mean, we now have learned that they stopped any nuclear weapons program in 2003. Is it just the cash? Is it just?
Well, you know, they have a lot of history in the background there. That, I mean, I don't think this is a good idea, and especially not for them, because it stirs up trouble that they scarcely need. But after all, they did join NATO, and they developed the idea that the path to safety. I mean, they were dominated by Russia, the Soviet Union, throughout the Cold War period. And that was a very horrible experience for them. So they're looking for a defender. So if the U.S. comes and says, we want to do X, Y, or Z, it tends to get a friendly reception. Although actually, public opinion in both countries is rather against this because they don't care to stir up this trouble.
Sure. Well, you know what the coalition, so-called forces in Iraq, have been called is the coalition of the billing. And this is very profitable to have our tax money being spent, you know, not completely, but a large expenditure, probably hundreds of millions of dollars in these facilities in the Czech Republic and Poland. So there, I mean, through all of it, of course, comes the military-industrial complex, transfer of wealth that we provide as taxpayers. And rather than coming back to us in goods and services and first responders and good roads and schools, it's all part of this new Cold War.
Well, it is, and if somebody doesn't stop that complex, it just keeps rolling forward because it's got its own momentum, and right now there's nobody to stand up and say no to it.
Jonathan Schell and me, Peter Werbe, well, we're going to say no. We hope a lot of other people will as well. The Seventh Decade is Jonathan Schell's new book about the seventh decade of nuclear capacity in terms of warfare. And the subtitle is A New Shape of Nuclear Danger. So we're told in, you know, last year and the year, 2005, that Iran was on the path to developing a nuclear weapons system, and they were a threat to the region, even to Europe, and now we're told no, they dismantled it in 2003. Must be pretty difficult, but from your vantage point, Jonathan Schell, any observations about what's going on in Iran in terms of nuclearism?
Well, you know, this technology for making a nuclear weapon, the scientists knew it way back in 1945, that over the long run, it's like any technology, it's like any science, any knowledge. It's going to be available to anybody. And now we're reaching that point when a country like Iran or North Korea is able to obtain it if they make the effort. And Iran has been enriching uranium, they say for nuclear power purposes, not for weapons. And we had the recent dispute over that with the National Intelligence Estimate. But the fact is they are enriching the uranium, and that brings them very close, or will bring them very close if they continue down that path, to having the material for the bomb. They just have to go a little further, enrich it a lot more, but with the same technology to get a bomb. So what we're really facing in Iran is a symptom of a much, much deeper problem that you see on a global basis, whether that's India, Pakistan, North Korea, or other countries that are around the world that are getting interested in nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And what basically it is, you know, they say with global warming that as the ice sheets melt, the sea levels are going to rise. Well, with the nuclear danger, or this what I call this new shape of it, you have another rising sea level, except what it is not the ocean, it's knowledge. It's this technical knowledge of how to make this thing that is rising and spreading around the world, making it possible for more and more people to get into this business. So that's why we're suddenly seeing it breaking out in different forms around the country, in the Middle East and the Far East, and so on and so forth. And so it's knocking at our door again, and it's become a very unsexy subject. It's kind of dropped off the public agenda, but we've forgotten about it, but it hasn't forgotten about us, and it's back, and it's in our face, and we better start learning what's happening and looking at it and seeing it in its entirety, because you can't look at it just one little piece of the jigsaw puzzle at a time.
Well, okay, that's sort of what I was going to get to as we near the end of our conversation with Jonathan Schell, and that is we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. We don't want anyone to have nuclear weapons. Iran, of course, is portrayed as led by madmen who are, given the chance, would probably nuke Israel or the Czech Republic or something like that. But how do we alter this process?
Well, you know, I have to argue with one thing. You said we don't want anyone to have them. We want us to have them.
Well, I meant we, sort of you and me.
I know what you meant. We want us to have them. We want England and France to have them. And now it looks like we want India to have them. So really what we're going to the world with is the idea we can have them, you can't, and if you try to get them, we'll bomb you. And we'll use our nuclear weapons to bomb you. Now, that's a formula that doesn't go over very well with other countries around the world. In fact, it's really untenable. And that is the underlying reason, in my opinion, that we're seeing all this proliferation, because countries are saying, look, you're holding on to it. You're threatening us with it. You have a program in the Pentagon called Global Strike that enables you to hit any spot on Earth with a nuclear or a conventional weapon. So where do you get off telling us not to have it? So what I think should be done in order to deal with proliferation, I think that the nuclear powers, all of them, there are nine now, I won't list them, need to come to the bargaining table with their own arsenals. Well, that's a big pile of chips, right?
Sure.
That would be a very, very powerful bargaining counter if you went to a global negotiating session and said, look, we're ready to draw ours down and go down to zero over a period of 10 years. That was the period that Reagan and Gorbachev named, by the way, so I think it's realistic. You say, we're getting out of this business. But you don't get in it. You can't get in it. We're leaving this stuff behind. And at that point, I think you'd have a united will, first of all, among superpowers, but second, among the rest of the world, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, most countries, and don't want people to have them, not us, not anybody, be a tremendous and an irresistible pressure of a kind of united global will to tell those proliferators and the possessors, let's leave this behind.
But it's got to be led.
An age without this threat.
I'm sorry. It's got to be led by the U.S., though.
I think it does. Or to put it differently, it goes nowhere without the U.S. So, and we've led the way for better and worse. You know, we invented the thing. We used it. We invented the H-bomb, the multiple independent reentry vehicle, and all kinds of other things. We were sort of the pioneer of the nuclear strategic theories eventually adopted by Russia and so forth. So it's our baby in a very, very deep sense. I mean, in a deeper sense, it's a universal problem. But in a historical sense, it's our baby. And so it makes a lot of sense for us to step forward and say, we gave birth to this monster. We're going to lead the way in strangling it and bringing us into a less endangered world.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan Schell. Jonathan Schell's brand new book is The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger. You can go to hholt.com. You can buy the book through Amazon or at your local independent bookstore. Go there first. Or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. I'll have a link there. Jonathan Schell, as usual, thanks for joining me.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10. Exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Present Rock for a Cause. It's all happening this Friday night at Teddy's Times Square in Clinton Township. Join WRIF's own Steve Black starting at 8 p.m. for a silent auction, including tickets to see Trans-Siberian Orchestra December 26th at the Palace, part of the Miller Lite Concert Series. Also, an autographed Metallica guitar, a very unique TSO signed and framed piece of artwork, an autographed copy of Nikki Sixx's Heroin Diaries, sports memorabilia provided by Sports Authentics in Rochester Hills, and so much more. Plus, get your picture with Santa Claus and rock out with great live music from the Allies. All proceeds from the auction will benefit the Sabrina Black Foundation. Log on to SabrinaBlackFoundation.org for more info. Rock for a Cause. This Friday night at Teddy's Times Square, Hayes Road, between M59 Hall Road and 21 Mile in Clinton Township. From Miller Lite and 101 WRIF.
Everything rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank Thank you very much for joining me. I think all of you know that there's a strike going on that's affecting millions and millions and millions of people. That's the strike of the Writers Guild that has withdrawn its labor for writing material for television shows. And that includes not just the late nights, and somehow that gets talked about the most, but also all the shows that we've come to love and that are part of our viewing experience, part of our culture. Joining me from New York City is Chris Albers. Chris Albers is the former president of the Writers Guild East. He's currently a monologue writer on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and he's also written for Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, and David Letterman. It's a pleasure to welcome Chris Albers to the Peter Werby Show. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I should say, what do they always say? Full disclosure. I'm a member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA, so there's a built-in sympathy on my part, although we won't talk about some of the differences that have occurred. Chris Albers, tell us, what are the issues here? I mean, oftentimes when people just want their shows back and they think, why does one side give in? What's going on here in the broadest terms?
Well, there are a lot of issues and certainly a lot being talked about in the press, and a lot of what you read in the press is spin from one side or the other. Regardless of what you're reading, it really boils down to the internet and new technologies. There's all these new delivery systems now. I believe that your show benefits from that as well, both on the internet as well as people downloading the show to their iPods and so there's all these new areas where our content is being reused, and they, as of now, are saying that we don't deserve to be compensated for that. In the past, when new technologies have come about, such as basic cable or even the VHS tape, which became the DVD, they have said exactly what they're saying to us right now. We're not making money there yet. Give us a chance to get our feet on the ground, and once there's a business model, we'll be happy to talk to you. We'll be happy to share those profits.
Now, that sounds reasonable to me.
It certainly does. And so we went along with that in the past, and we did exactly what they asked us to do. And we waited, and then 3 years later, we would come back, and we would go to negotiate our next contract, and they would refuse to discuss those topics. And so basic cable got on its feet without writers. And then what you ended up having was they still wanted to use our union writers, so they were getting people to use aliases, and writers were feeling dirty, and most of the writers weren't doing that work. But you created that type of market. With VHS tapes, they said that wasn't going to be a big market for them. They said that there's very little money there, and this could end up hurting theatrical releases. So you've got to give us a break here. So we did that. And then they eventually gave us a horrible deal where we get about 4 cents for every movie that they sell, and that was back when they were selling VHS tapes for $80, $90. They then switched to
go ahead. This is all very interesting to me.
They then switched the VHS tapes over to DVDs, and although the quality is so much better, the cost of production is minuscule compared to VHS tapes. There's no moving parts. They just stamp them out on a machine. So their profits went way up. People decided, because of the quality was so good, they built entire libraries of films. They refused over the last 20 years to revisit that formula. We still get 4 cents out of every $20 DVD that's sold. So we're not going to do that again with the internet, because the difference here is in 5 to 10 years, everything will be either internet or new technologies. And if all that we have defended during that time is broadcast television, we'll find ourselves without any power.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris Albers, I mean, it's partly about power. It's partly certainly about income. And the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers are in fact, full-page ads that probably many of us have seen in the newspaper portray the Writers Guild of America as being greedy, wanting 700% raises and some of the fees and all of that, and for writers that are already astronomically well paid. That's certainly the image that the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers are portraying.
It certainly is, and that's what I'm talking about. They just hired two big money guys that have worked in political campaigns, and they've actually brought them in from used to work with Bill Clinton.
Huh.
And I think what they're doing there is they're trying to soften up Hollywood, where they still need to keep the FCC happy. They're trying to appeal to those people that normally they would be against. They proposed their latest offer was called a new economic partnership. Now, doesn't that sound like Washington?
Yeah.
And they then put an offer on the table that was almost identical to the last offer that they put on the table. When they say we're asking for 700% increases, they're talking about that 4 cents. We're asking for something like 7 cents out of $20. Isn't that greedy for content that we create? I could write the Chris Albers story, and it could be my whole life, and I spent years writing it. And for the Chris Albers story, I get 4 cents. There is no content without us. We create the content. So, you know, I know there's kind of a lack of support across the country these days for unions, and I think it's because we've been portrayed in the wrong way. And I think some unions have even in the past defended the wrong things and tried to defend jobs that we really shouldn't have. And I think that we hurt ourselves a little bit. But I also think that the Fox News coverage of unions and the working people has really hurt the situation. And in our case, nobody really looks at us as struggling workers. They look at us the way that the companies portray us, as somebody who has an average salary of $200,000, which just is not true, but they keep repeating it, so people believe that. Writers are lucky to have a career that lasts 5 years. I've been writing professionally since 1995. I'm a rare and lucky writer. Most people, it's like a professional athlete. Do they make a lot of money? And compared to us, a hell of a lot of money. But they may have a career that lasts 3-5 years. The same with us. The difference is what we create during that 3 to 5 years. These companies will go on for decades, if not centuries, with some of the animation stuff, and repurpose our content. And we will just watch that generate revenue, the thing that came out of our mind. And they're trying to shut us out of that. It's something we just cannot stand by and watch happen.
Chris Albers is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's the former president of the Writers Guild of America East, and he's currently a monologue writer on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, although currently he's on the picket lines. Is this just from the sound of your voice, I suspect you weren't around in 1988, the last strike, or...
Actually, I started as an intern at the David Letterman show, Late Night with David Letterman at the time. It's now Late Night with Conan O'Brien. I started there 4 days before the strike, and it was my dream come true. I was just a fan. I didn't know anybody. I tried to position myself in the right place, and here was everything I ever wanted in the whole world. And then 4 days later, the writer's strike happened, and there wasn't another show for the rest of my internship.
Oh, boy.
So I absolutely remember 1988, but I think the difference between 1988, other than that for me, I'm been lucky enough since then to have a career. The difference is that in 88, like in most other struggles, there were dozens of issues, and you had, I think, what we ended up staying out for at the very end of 88 was because they were trying to cut the repeat fees for one-hour dramas. Well, there's something everybody can rally around, you know, I guess if you write an hour drama, but the rest of the union was a little confused. The other issue was fighting over foreign residuals for reusing our stuff internationally. Well, those are things that certainly should have been fought for and were, but it's not something everybody understands. The difference this time is every single person in our union understands how important the internet is, and that's why you're seeing the turnout on the picket lines that you've been seeing, even though it's below freezing here in New York.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, actually. So this kind of activity out there in the picket lines and chanting and showing up at broadcast sites and all that, this is not what you've done over a lifetime. I mean, one maybe expects this with industrial unions with a long tradition of striking. But on the other hand, the Writers Guild of America has always, since its inception, been there for its members, but still, this must be pretty unique activity for you and others.
It is, and, you know, the first thing, of course, is we're certainly not whining about this or feeling we have it bad, you know, especially not in Detroit, where you guys have had so many people showing solidarity and walking picket lines for months and months in freezing cold. And so, you know, we're certainly not poor us. But we are a pretty shy group. That's why we're writers, and putting us out on the picket line and getting us to scream and make noise and call attention to ourselves pretty much does go against everything that we are about, just because we're these odd little creatures that became writers because we weren't so socially acceptable. So so it's a little odd. But, I think despite these temperatures and despite the fact that it's unnatural for us to be doing this, everybody understands how important it is. And we don't hear on the line. Some people will ask, well, was this the right move? Or, what's the real story behind this? And once we explain what happened, they're like, all right, keep it up. You know, and we just have had such amazing commitments from our members that I think they are foolish if they think we're going to go away.
Now, well, I would think, too, that, I mean, the first thing that occurred to me, and then I realized how long the last Writers Guild strike went on for, that you essentially, can I say this on the air, you'd have them by the cojones, you know, that that these shows cannot exist without the writers. I mean, we can talk about the reality shows in a little while, but the shows that depend on the writers, the genius of the writers, the creative ability, you take that away, you got a bunch of repeats. And here I'm looking at Variety for December 6th. It says Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Chris Albers, you're a monologue writer. It's dropped off, the audience dropped off over a third. So that's killing them. What... Why do I mean, you think they'd say, okay, anything?
Well, I think that it's about shutting us out in the future. And I think that they feel if they can be successful as they've done in the past, that they won't have to readdress this. And then all the profits will be theirs down the road. And, of course, we're not foolish enough to stand by and see that happen again. It is just greed, and it's beyond me, because for the amount of money that they've lost so far, we broke down what we were asking for. And if we got every single penny of what we were asking for, we broke down what it would cost the different networks. And I can get you this information so you have the exact numbers, but I think the highest network was NBC, and it was going to be about $12 million a year. The lowest, I believe, was MGM, and it was going to be about $500,000 a year. Most of the companies, it was going to cost about $2 to $3 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a 3-year contract. We've already seen hundreds of millions of dollars lost between advertiser givebacks and between productions that have been shut down and that were already full going. And so I can't understand why they would be doing this. They last week and this week is pretty much the deadline where they're going to have to cancel the rest of this season. In a number of weeks or a couple of weeks, they're going to have to cancel pilot season, so there, which would be normally all the shows that they'd be wanting to put on the air next spring.
Sure.
Or next fall, excuse me. So I just can't understand this. We're not that far apart. The only reason to do this is if they think they can either break the union completely, or if they think that that they can shut us out enough to have all the profits, at least for the next couple of decades. But we're not going to go away, and so this situation is just going to get worse and worse for everybody. And the part that bothers us is we have friends and people that we care a lot about. There's thousands and thousands of people on our staffs and crews that some of whom have a union, but a lot of the staff members do not. And those people are stuck in the middle without jobs because the studios won't settle with us.
Well, Chris Albers, let's actually talk about that for a while in terms of how people are perceiving you. You mentioned probably the most right-wing network of them all, Fox News, and how they were portraying you. One would expect that. I mean, they're very conservative. They're anti-union. I believe at least the beginning of the Writers Guild strike is that public opinion seems solidly on the side of the writers. So is that your memory of the polls?
It has been. I mean, I think to get the general public engaged in this at all is difficult. Then to have sympathy for people that they believe have really fun glamorous jobs is difficult. And yet, despite that, the polls that have been taken, people do seem to be standing with us. I remember one specific poll where it said something like 55% of people supported us. And you think, all right, well, that sounds good, but it's not that much. But 2% supported the company's position, and then the rest were sort of indifferent. And that's pretty good. We'll take that.
Yeah. Now, you're a monologue writer with Conan O'Brien. What is, it seems like most of the hosts have been, at least of the late night shows, have been pretty supportive of your strike.
They have been. And I will say that as a monologue writer, probably the one one nice part of this is that I've been able to completely stop watching Paris Hilton and Britney Spears' careers for a couple months here, which is a very, very welcome break from that. The hosts have been incredible. It's they're in this awkward position. The sitcoms and dramas basically have to shut down because they run out of scripts and you can't ad-lib those shows. Our shows tend to be the first affected because we start fresh every day and we try and be as topical as possible. So we immediately go on strike, and then the networks make a significant portion of their profits, up to 40% for some of them, from their late night programs because they don't have different sets to create, they don't have a huge cast to pay. They have one host, they have one set, and all the people that come on make scale because they're coming on to promote something. So they're huge cash cows. So from day one, the networks are leaning on these hosts saying, we want you back on the air with or without writers. And those guys, by choosing to stand with us, are basically saying to their staffs, you're going to either be out of work or we're going to have to pay you ourselves, because the networks after a while don't want to help keep that going. Why would they? They want to create more pressure for us to go back. So these hosts have done that. They realize how important this is. They know that if one of them crosses, the others will follow. It's not 1988 where we only have Carson and Letterman. There's 10 different shows now. And so they've just been incredible, and now almost all of them are paying their staffs out of their own pockets because the companies stopped paying their salaries.
Which is considerable. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of support staff. Now, I assume that David Letterman and Conan and the rest of them are members of my union, AFTRA. Am I correct?
That is true.
Yeah. So, but they're really not restricted. They could, and certainly a show of Conan O'Brien with Chris Albert writing the monologue is more than Conan could do on his own, yet he could dispense with the monologue and just say, hi, I'm Conan O'Brien, I'm going to interview Britney Spears tonight, and here she is, give her a big hand. So, I mean, they're actually out in solidarity, is that correct?
They certainly are able to go back on the air and do shows. There are rules about what they can do without violating the strike rules, but as AFTRA members, they are allowed to go on the air and perform stuff that they've written for themselves. Where it gets sticky is they cannot perform struck work, and struck work is anything that would normally be written by the writers on strike. So they cannot, in fact, go out and do a monologue, even if they write it themselves, because that's struck work. David Letterman cannot do a top 10 because that's struck work. Yeah. So it's really difficult for these guys. The networks are pushing them back on the air. If they go back on the air, they're going to do a show that vaguely resembles the old show. They can come out and do a Jack Part style old monologue where they come out and talk about their day and getting to work, but it would have to really be them just ad-libbing.
Mm. Well, tell us a little about monologue writing, because we think of Letterman as so funny, and Conan O'Brien and Jay Leno and the rest of them. We're cracking up, yet they've just got a good delivery, or is there more to it than that? Is it all, I mean, obviously you have to have a good delivery, but and you guys are partners, but tell us the process quickly of the importance of the role that the writers play in late-night television.
Well, like I said, there at this point there are 10 of these hosts, and I would say almost every single one of those hosts is capable of writing anything that's on their show. As you know, putting a show together, there's just so many elements to keep on track. And so these guys have to oversee the booking and meet with segment producers to find out what they're going to talk to the guests about, and just general staff issues and this and that. So they don't have the time, and that's why we are doing what we are doing. We come in every morning and we start with that day's papers and with the internet sites that we check on. There's probably a couple dozen news sites I check every day. And I make several pages of notes about what's being talked about in the country. And occasionally while I'm doing that, I'll write down a joke I think of. But generally, I then take that and go back and then use those as setups of what's on people's minds. And I just try and write jokes off of that. There's about four of us that do this. And then we get together, we have a meeting together, and we read our jokes and try and make them better a little bit before we then take them into Conan. He reads them. Tells us which ones he likes. He changes some a little bit. He'll say, I like this area, but I don't think you have the punchline. Let's try harder on this area. And then we just keep meeting back and forth like that until showtime. And every day you run out of time and wish you had more, and you just put the best of what you have at that point on the air.
Yeah, I like it when I've done syndicated talk shows. I had a boss one time who told me, he said, you only work 3 hours a day, which is the closest I've come to violence probably in the last 20 years or so. My guest is Chris Albers. We just have a few minutes left with him. He's the former president of the Writers Guild of America. You can go to WGAEast.org. Also on my website, I have some blogs that discuss the issues of the strike at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. The thing that always struck me, and I remember watching Letterman, and was the first time he disparaged George W. Bush, I looked at my wife and I said, see change. Because you guys, or what's the process of having your finger so well on the pulse of America? Because, you know, if that would have been in, say, November of 2001, that he would have made some joke at George Bush's expense, he probably would have been kicked off the air, right?
Right, right.
But somehow he knew that the times they were a-changing.
Yeah, I guess, and I think Dave is also at a point in his career where Dave just says what Dave thinks now, and Dave, but you're exactly right. If he had said something too harsh shortly after September 11th, that would have been a different reaction. But I think he can get away with things that others can't. I think that we're always taking the temperature to see what is funny. I mean, we're not. I think there's some shows that Bill Maher and even The Daily Show, to some extent, that are making political points. But that's not really most of our role. I mean, most of us are there to make people laugh at the end of their day, and we're not trying to change people's political parties, and we just want to make people laugh. So you want to find what that common ground is. You don't want to serve up softballs that aren't edgy at all or that aren't smart, but you want to find the common ground where at least 60% of us can laugh and not be offended. And then you walk up to that edge a little bit, and you back off, and you just do that every day, and you find out where it is.
120 seconds left. 60 seconds on reality shows. That threatens both my union, because you have people on there that aren't being paid union scale for performing, and they don't need the Writers Guild either, and they're talking about increasing greatly the number of reality shows.
Right, and I think that the public's had about as much of that as they want. It's they keep throwing more at us, and only a few remain, and even the successful franchises are dying off. And lastly, I'll tell you, you know, as these shows ate up the schedule, and we lost sitcoms and dramas, writers lost jobs. But those writers were hired on these reality shows. Same writers that are said not to be writing on these reality shows. They shoot hundreds and hundreds of hours of tapes, and then writers go through those tapes, and they tell stories through their editing. And so that's why we're struggling over reality TV, although I don't think it's as big an issue as the Internet. But their reality shows aren't even reality shows. We're writing those, too.
30 seconds, then. When's it going to end?
Well, we're hoping, I mean, we're going to keep up the pressure, and yet we're going to also remain reasonable and try and get back to the table. We'll go back as soon as we go back tomorrow if they'd come back to the table. So,
are you hopeful?
I think they're going to try and play us against each other. They're going to try and separate the unions, and I'm not sure the unions are going to fall for that this time because we're all in the same boat.
Well, thank you so much, Chris Albers, for giving us the union side of the Writers Guild strike. We shall see. Are we going to get all our favorite people back? Well, I hope so. You can go to the Writers Guild of America East website, wgaeast.org. You can go to my website, peterwerby.com, and you can see some blogs about it. Chris Albers, thanks for spending the time with us.
Thank you, Peter. Have a good day.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
To gather round and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.
A date which will live in infamy.
Good evening, adults. We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a very special presentation.
Boring. Go back to that infamy guy.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Happy Monday morning to you. What a Monday out there, too. So we got a little case of the apocalypse outside. Snow is still falling in some areas, too. It's supposed to move out of the way at some point tonight, though. And it's supposed to hold off onto us until, Wednesday. 2 days off, maybe. Last time I checked, though, it was supposed to hold off till Thursday. Now it's Wednesday, so I'm saying expect snow showers later this afternoon, all night long, so we're buried up to our ears. 101 WRIF, my name is Alan Beck, they call me Slayer. In now after Peter Werby and Night Call here on The Riff. Lots of stuff coming up today, including the Mighty Met on the way. Also, Ozzy Osbourne is in town tomorrow night. We'll crank out some stuff from him. Also, Surge, Pearl Jam, and more. And your request, a phone call away at 313-298-WRIF. Also, Slayer at WRIF.com via email. Let's do it up. Jade's hanging out in the studio today, answering phone calls, running the board, doing everything. So it seems so appropriate to crank it up with Sex Type Thing. For you, Jade. Stone Temple Pilots, kicking off the late night overnight with me, Slayer, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks in the Motor City, it is The Riff.